My kitty cats are great. I spend a great deal of time with them, but they fail to seem to enjoy television shows with me, or for that matter, anything else. Well, except the snap of the opening of a can of cat food. That they know. Anyway, good evening, everybody. It's going to be a fun night. Scott Flansburg is here. And Scott is the human calculator. You may have seen him all over the place. I mean, he's been everywhere. He's been on Howard Stern. That's when you know you've been everywhere. And Jay Leno and Dateline and ABC's Good Morning America and 700 Club and Primetime American Regis and Kathy Lee and CNN, Daywatch and, you know, all of them. And, of course, the ESPN World Series of Poker. Now, that's where I saw Scott on the World Series of Poker. I'm a big fan of the World Series of Poker. God, it's intense. It really is intense. And that's where I saw Scott. So we're in a moment, we're going to interview the human calculator, a man who can just astound you. And I know you've probably seen him in one of these venues, so I don't know that I'm going to concentrate so much on having him do stuff, because I know he can do it. I'm more interested in how and how it began and, you know, all that kind of stuff. In a moment. By the way, the human calculator was a moniker bestowed upon Scott, apparently by Regis Philbin. So I can't believe that any of you out there have not seen him. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Art. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. Where are you located, by the way?
I live in Phoenix, Arizona, but for this show I drove up to Sedona, and I actually have a view of your favorite rock up here, probably Bell Rock.
Oh, yeah. So you drove to Sedona just to be on the program?
It's my favorite place to come out and relax and sort of just try to – I have a lot of ideas and inventions and things, so this is where I come to clear my head. And,
it is beautiful, isn't it?
It's breathtaking, and it never gets old.
All right, so here we go. I did see you, by the way, on the World Series of Poker. That was fascinating. They showed you rattling off 5 miles a minute. And, you know, but I want to know, I guess everybody wants to know, how you do it.
Well, Art, if I would have met you or interviewed with you years ago, I would have just told you that I had all kinds of shortcuts and tricks and ideas on how to make mental math fun and easy, and that's what I was selling for years. And a few years ago, I had an epiphany about numbers, and the secret of numbers revealed itself to me, and I would love to share it with you tonight.
The secret of numbers revealed itself to you?
Yeah. I was playing golf on 9999. On September 9th, 1999,
yeah, in
Phoenix with Alice Cooper. And we were on the 18th hole, and Alice looked at me and said, "Hey, I wrote a song called 18. 1 plus 8 is 9.
Well, he knew who you were, right?
We're very close friends.
Oh, I see, so you're always thinking numbers anyway.
Yeah, he puts up with me. He calls himself the anti-math guy, and I'm the math guy. So, and he just asked me the right question at the right time, and I explained to him why any number times 9, the answer will add up to 9. And he could care less, and that was that. But as I was driving home from the round, this pattern revealed itself to me. I'm working on a new calendar that's a 13-month calendar, and I was thinking about the number 13. And I just added the digits of the number together, and then I subtracted that total from the number. So I said, okay, 13. 1 plus 3 is 4. 13 minus 4 is 9. And I just started laughing because it was 9999. I just thought it was like a coincidence. And then I walked in the house and I saw the number 11, and I said, 1 and 1 is 2. 11 minus 2 is 9. And it just sort of unraveled itself. And I sat down and I just started breaking down numbers as big as I could. And it worked for every single number. And
well, I'm glad all this works for you.
Yeah.
I'm glad. But I don't buy the fact that I don't think I buy the fact that you can essentially help anybody to do this. I really don't think that. I think you're a savant.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to show you that I can teach you or anybody in less than 1 minute how to turn on the calculator in your brain that's always been there, that we just didn't know how to turn on the power button.
You're welcome to try.
Okay, if I'm a human calculator, and when I'm speaking to you as a human, I'm using the English language, And I have to use the 26 letters of the alphabet, A through Z.
Yeah.
And what I'm speaking to you is a calculator.
Yes.
I'm using the 10 digits, 0 through 9. And if you had a calculator, if you turned it on, the first thing that shows up is a 0. And a calculator is wired to start at 0. And that's what allows it to do what it does. And the human mind is wired to start thinking about numbers at 1. We all count our fingers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Yeah.
We don't, we're just sort of wired that way. But now that you know that the first digit is 0 and the 10 digits are 0 through 9,
yeah.
9 is the biggest single digit. And the secret is just every number you see, Art, will go down to 9. So like everybody listening to your show right now, if they would just think of their age, how many years old they are, just the two-digit number, add those digits together, and now take that total and subtract it from your age. And everyone should get an answer that adds up to the number 9. So, for example, I'm 42, so I did 4 plus 2 is 6, and 42 minus 6 is 36. And that answer, 36, adds up to 9. And what it is, Art, is that it's a checker for the human brain to tell you if you're right or wrong. So now you don't need a calculator or a teacher to tell you you're wrong when you need to know what 1 plus 1 is. Instead of using your memory, you can logically figure out the answer because the number 11 was designed to teach you 1 plus 1. There's a 1 and a 1 there for the number 11. And you just add them up and you get 2. 11 minus 2 is 9. And that tells you that everything's okay. And you can't make a mistake. If you tonight you're tired and you think 1 plus 1 is 3, you would do 11 minus 3, and that's not 9.
But, Scott, I've seen what you've done.
Mm-hmm.
Come on now. No, not everybody's going to be able to do this. There is something different about you.
I'll show you the one thing, Art, that I do that I can't explain, and that's my Guinness World Record, where I can just count by any number you say. So, you know, we don't need a calculator. I promise you, I'm just this is just natural. It happens so fast, my mouth actually slows me down.
I know.
Going so fast.
I know.
But just throw out a two-digit number, and I'm just going to start counting by it.
61.
122, 183, 244, 305, 366, 427, 488, 549, 610, 671, 732, 793, 8549, 159, 761, 037, 1098, 1159, 1220, 1281.
All right, stop. After that, it begins to get painful. All right, see, I don't care how much the epiphany says nine. The average person is not going to be able to do that. Now, obviously, there's something different about your brain. So my first question is, have they taken you in for, MRIs, CAT scans, whatever might look at your brain and try and figure out what's cattywampus?
Yeah, Discovery Channel has a show called More Than Human, and they took me to the UCLA Neurobiological Research Center and hooked my brain up to a computer and all the little fuzzies coming out of it and attached on, and he had me do my world record, and the only problem was is that my mouth was moving, and it was actually messing up the readings because of the side movement. So he said, okay, Scott, this time I'm going to pick a number and say it out loud, and I just want you to count by it, but just do it in your head. Don't say it out loud. And he said a number, and it just lit up, and it showed that my entire brain just gets so focused. It's like a laser. As soon as you said 61, I can just see a path of 61 through the number line.
61 right on down the line.
Right. Like, I'm already 20, 30 deep. I mean,
I was going to ask. Do you see it far further down the line than you can say it?
Well put, Art. You're the word guy. I'm the numbers guy. You just said it better than I ever have.
God, that's amazing. So there's something. Let's go back now. They did what? An MRI?
No, it was more of just a test where the activity of my brain was.
Uh-huh. And it showed that all the synapses lit up like light bulbs or what?
Yeah, it was pretty freaky. I never really had anything done like that before. Even as a kid, I was considered a prodigy and never got tested. And it was just fascinating to sit there and watch a computer screen light up on purpose because of a thought, not because of something you said.
All right. Well, you know, that's my next question. Take me back to your youth. When did you or other people around you begin to figure out that you were a little different?
I remember it very clearly, actually, that it was in fourth grade, and I was sitting in the back of the room talking to my buddy about baseball. And the teacher had just shown us how to carry when you have to add up a column of numbers, you have to carry to the tens and such. And we wasn't listening. I was talking about baseball, and she saw that I wasn't listening, so she picked me to come up to the board and do the first example. And I walked up there and total fear. And for some reason, I just did it backwards. I said, well, there's 10, and 10 more is 20, and 10 more is 30, plus 2 is 32, plus 2 is 34, plus 2 is 36. So I just said the answer out loud, 36. And she said, well, how'd you do that? And then I did another one with a carry, and she's like, how are you doing that so fast? And I said, well, it's real easy. You just go like this. And it just made sense to me.
And this was in like the fourth grade.
9 years old.
9 years old.
And it just made sense.
Do you remember any effects in your brain even before that? And I guess to you, it wouldn't be unusual. It wouldn't be abnormal. For you, it would appear to be the absolute norm until somebody else, like a teacher, said, oh, my God.
Exactly right. I really thought that all adults and teachers could do this stuff, and I was just way ahead of the kids in my class.
Right.
And then my parents took me to the grocery store. We have a lot of kids, no money. And my mom said, okay, $150, tell me when to stop. And so I would just walk by the cart and add it up and tell her. And my dad got a kick out of it, and he would actually ask me for the exact amount, and he would write out the check before they started registering it up. So we had fun with it, and it was no big deal to me for a long time.
Scott, do you make your living as the human calculator?
Yeah, I didn't make it through school. I never graduated. I didn't work out my senior year. I had a little personality conflict with my English teacher, and he failed me by 1 point on my last credit of my last day. So
figures.
It was a little bit of a bummer. So I went in the Air Force for 6 years. I did intelligence with OSI over in Japan and got to do some fun stuff and a couple of years of computer programming. And then
Wait a moment. Did the military find your talent, I'll call it, useful?
Yeah, I was actually going to be just an administrative assistant for a priest up at a church in Sunnyvale, California, and a TV show did an interview on me. They had heard something about me, about my number skills, and so they asked to come on base and interview me, and the commander asked what it was about, and the OSI heard about it, the Office of Special Investigations, and they asked me to do a special duty assignment in Japan. So it was an amazing opportunity, and I had a blast. I did some pretty interesting stuff and had some really crazy experiences.
And then now, as an adult, you've been on all of these TV shows. But, you know, I know most of these shows, and they're not going to pay you much.
Zero. I haven't taken any money for my time in 18 years, Art.
So then how come you're not starving to death?
Well, you know, when you sell books about mental math, you know, you're not making a killing either. It's not the big hot topic. So it's a challenge. But I made a commitment 18 years ago when I got out of the Air Force. I on 8/8/88, and I said, you know, I'm going to give this thing a shot and see if I can do this without taking money from kids or schools.
Yeah, and, well, I don't want to murder your book sales at all. But I'm stuck on this thought that not everybody by a long shot can do what you're doing, and you have some, you know, obviously special wiring in your brain, you know, and if we could figure out how you do what you do, and we could begin to change the human brain, my God, we could change the world, I guess.
I feel the same way, Art, and that's my goal and my mission, and that's I'm using this gift not to impress people with what I can do, but I really feel like my gift is that I can share my insight to numbers to people in a very simple way that allows them an opportunity to at least have a positive experience with numbers to get them started in the right direction. And I believe I'm developing the tools now to show people a way to see numbers like we've had the wrong prescription lenses. We're off by one. And now we're going to get the right prescription lenses to see numbers clearly.
It's strange you should mention that. I just got a brand new pair of progressive glasses, and my brain is still trying to adjust to them at this very moment. Got them a couple days ago.
Exactly. And that's how we see everything. All of us, everything around us is numbers, and most of us just block it out. We wear dark sunglasses so we don't have to think about it, but it invades every part of our life and being. It's just the way it is. And for us to block it all the time isn't healthy either. So I really feel like a way to just feel comfortable with numbers in everyday life and not have that anxiety is a huge step for us.
Have you ever tried to block it? In other words, I would think that with the way you are, numbers would be, in some ways, a burden because you'd be seeing them constantly, doing math constantly. I remember learning the Morse code. It was when I was a youngster, 13 years old, and but still to this very day, I tap out the Morse code when I see billboards and signs. And so, what about you?
I knew it. I can't. It's consuming sometimes. It's like everybody's blind, and I can see things, and I want to point it out to everybody and say, "Wow, look at Fibonacci in nature. Look at the prime numbers. Look at these amazing things." And people are like, "Yeah, whatever." So it's tough. It's a tough sell. I mean, it's just become socially accepted to be stupid in mathematics. And I hate to use the word stupid. It's a little mean and derogatory. But it's become socially accepted to not be any good at math. But if tonight we were on the show, Art, and I said, "Hey, I sent you my press kit. Didn't you read it?" You're like, "Hey, I can't really read or write." It's no big deal, though. If you were illiterate, people would look at you differently.
Well, sure.
But if you're innumerate, which is illiterate with numbers, which a lot of people have because they've just never tried, I believe that's contagious. Kids are getting it from parents every day. It's perpetuating itself. And the only difference that ever is going to occur is when people have a new opportunity and a new way to see numbers.
All right. Well, here's a question for you. Music, beyond any question, is mathematical.
All math.
Oh, man, it's all math. And so I wonder if your reaction to music or the way you enjoy music or hear it is in any way different than the rest of us.
Yeah, I really do. I don't know music, but being around Alice a lot, I've learned a lot about music and how he sort of interprets it. And,
yes.
And it is the same kind of language as I see math. And I do. I enjoy music tremendously. Living around the world, I've got to experience a lot of different kinds. And though I can't understand the words to most music, it still, it fills your being.
It doesn't matter. The beat and the rhythm of music are clearly mathematical. And I was just wondering if you sort of interpret that or you feel that as you hear music.
Yes, I do. I believe there's certain patterns that I'm acclimated to. Absolutely.
Do you see patterns in everything?
Everything. That's, I see order in chaos. I believe that we live in a world of chaos numerically, and my mind sees it in order.
Uh-huh. In Las Vegas, they ban, when they can identify them, they ban card counters.
Yeah.
I don't know how they legally do that. I've always wondered. Maybe you could explain that to me. But they do ban card counters. Now, is their position in banning card counters justified?
I don't agree with it. You're asking people not to think, which I just can't believe you can get away with that.
I couldn't believe it either. On what basis? So what? You're counting. Why? So what?
And Art, I sat down at many a blackjack table and handed them all my money that I had in my pocket and left. The numbers didn't add up. It didn't work out. It's not math. It's gambling. It's defined by math, but it's not math.
Well, nevertheless, maybe you can answer this. Counting the cards. If you can count them as well as you no doubt can, how much of an advantage does that give you in percentage points?
1% on the last few hands if you're at a six-shoe deck.
All right, listen, hold it.
Six-deck shoe.
Got it. Hold it right there. Human mind is way more than we know it is. The human mind is capable of things that, well, produce wonderment in the average person, certainly in me, absolute wonderment. And so when we talk about the minds being capable of so many things that to us seem, magical, just impossible, we ascribe things to mass human consciousness and all the rest of it. Think of it, folks. Scott can do this. Now, okay, he's a savant of sorts, no question about it. But that means the brain can do it. So the brain is capable of so much more that to us, as we look at it and listen to people like Scott, then baby, it's magic. So Scott, as I mentioned on this program, we deal all the time, with things that the human mind can do that seem to be, to the audience, to me, like magic. I mean, really, truly like magic, like leaving your body with nothing more than your brain and appearing elsewhere. I'll talk to Albert Taylor about that in the next hour. Or any number of other, this whole new mass consciousness thing that's going on. In fact, I may want you to comment for me on that a little bit. Do you have any thoughts on consciousness itself, what it really is, Scott, and whether the human mind has the ability to, with many other minds, essentially move mountains?
Yes, and I believe there's two states, Art. There's time and there's timeless, and we've all experienced timeless moments that just seemed extremely natural, that almost beyond definition or explanation. And then there's time, where we're grinding it out in time. And what you say is magical to me is mathematical. Like, I'm also known as the human calendar. Mm-hmm. You can give me any date. You know, like if you want, pick a date that's significant in your life that you might remember, or just a random date if you want, but just tell me the month, day, and the year, and I can calculate what day of the week that was on.
June 17th, 1945.
Sunday. Turned 18 on a Sunday, 21 on a Wednesday. This year it's a Saturday.
My birth date, of course.
Yes, and I can calculate any date like that in less than a second. And that isn't something that just happens, like the other thing where I was counting by a number, Art.
Actually, I was born on Sunday, Father's Day.
Yes, that's right. Thank you. And it happens, you know, the calendar's pretty messed up, but it repeats every 28 years. So if you like the way your birthday was, the year you were born, every 28 years it will repeat itself.
Do you have any thoughts on the Mayan calendar, which seems to abruptly end in 2012?
Yes, my calendar that I've invented, Art, is called the Human Calendar, and it's in synchronicity with the Mayan calendar. It's a, the Human Calendar is, I invented it in 99, the same time I discovered the nine pattern, and the Human Calendar is a 13-month calendar with 28 days, just like the Mayans, and the only difference is that I count zero. I use zero as a day and a month, and just by including that extra, that zero, it lines up the year perfectly, but the Mayans didn't know about zero. They called it the day out of time.
The day out of time.
Yeah, and so it was the same idea. And so all I have is a 13-month calendar, and it uses zero as a month and zero as a day, and it makes every month line up perfectly, Art, so that every date falls on the same day of the week every month.
I don't suppose there's any numerical clues in why the Mayans threw up their hands and said 2012 is, you know, did they get sick of making calendars or...
I think there's something very specific to it. You know, 2012 is a fascinating date, and they didn't say 2012. They actually said a date that's equivalent to 2012. A lot of people think they said December 21st, 2012, but they said the date that we know is December 21st, 2012. But
uh-huh.
I think there's something very mystical about it, in that I think that is going to be when we consider changing calendars, to use this new calendar that makes perfect mathematical sense, so that everyone on the planet would know what day of the week every date was on, and be able to count time in a very simple way as compared to the way that we organize time now. It runs our society.
If that's all that happens in 2012, I'm all for it.
Well, and if you do the math, Art, take 2012, December 21st, 2012, and add in from that date what the Bible calls the apocalypse, the revelation, you know, the apocalypse thing. That's 7 years.
Yes.
If you add 7 years to December 21st, 2012, that puts you at the end of 2019. And I believe the year 2020 will be the year that we see time clearly, with 2020 vision, and it will make sense to us.
Well, time is also all numbers. And by the way, speaking of numbers, there's a TV show, of course, called Numbers. I trust you've seen it.
Many times.
Do you like the theme?
I love it. I think anything to help people think numbers are cool. You know, I'm doing a campaign. I'm starting an event this fall, Art, that's called the National Counting Bee. And it's just like the National Spelling Bee, except we're going to find the fastest kid counter in America every year. And it's designed to get kids excited about math, to feel like mathletes, and to be rewarded for excellence in math, just like kids are for spelling and science and other skills.
Listen, Scott, it's a good thing I've got enough money, because I can't even balance my checkbook.
Well, I don't do miracles, Art, but I really feel like I can help people with basic math. You know, I can't do my checkbook. I don't even have one. I don't like numbers either. when it comes to everyday life.
So this is more of a avocation, and you wouldn't want it to be a vocation. You wouldn't want to be, I don't know, an accountant or something.
Exactly. Yeah, like that's the farthest thing from my mind. I've never been to college. I've never studied the higher maths. I've always stuck with realistic stuff. And, you know, it's really interesting, Art, that we live around numbers, and numbers and time are everything around us. And we still think about time and numbers like the Romans did 2,000 years ago. If you'd have met me 2,000 years ago and interviewed me as a human calculator, you wouldn't say 24 times 12. You would say XXIV times XII.
2,000 years ago, buddy, we'd have burned you. Listen.
Maybe you too.
Maybe. With all your understanding of numbers, I have to ask, you know, people will say, okay, Art, you were born on this date, and this gal was born on this date, and so you'll either be compatible or you'll not be. Numerology, is there anything to it?
No.
No.
There's two numerologies. There's a small N numerology and a capital N numerology. And small N numerology is the study of numbers and language, which, you know, the gematria or gematria, as people know it, is the Hebrew letters were also numbers, so every word is also a number, and the Greeks did that as well. And the Romans is sort of an example of the IVX thing, but we don't do that with ABC. We just don't associate numbers and letters that way.
Huh. Well, all right. So you sell a book. You've got a book, right?
Yeah, my book is Math Magic, and also Math Magic for Kids, and it's a national bestseller. It's been out there for 10 years, and I just redid it with that new 0 through 9, and I called it Chapter 0 to show people that zero counts, and that just got re-released. And I also have the calendar, is the human calendar, and people can download that for free. Art. Anybody can go to thehumancalendar.com and download it for free just to see what it would be like to experience time where it makes perfect sense to the human mind and the human body. And my DVD and workbooks are free, just they have to pay for shipping it. But I just want to get the ideas out there, Art. I really, I'm getting old. I'm already over 40 now. And, I've got to make sure that the 0 through 9 gets out there. And I've only got 7 years left before December 21st, 2012. And that's a lot. That's only a little time to convince people that there's a better way to keep track of time with a calendar.
Uh-huh.
So it's a fun project for me, and the National Accounting Bureau will take me around the country and give me a chance to have a platform to promote people getting more comfortable with numbers in everyday life and, these ideas out there.
You know, theoretical physicists, Scott, are looking for this formula that may be no longer than your thumb, they say, or it may be, but that represents the theory of everything. You know, Einstein was chasing it, and modern physicists are chasing it. Is there anything that you can tell me as you look down long lines of numbers that amounts to a real revelation for everybody?
Yes, two. I'll tell you two of them that I've come up with, Art, that I thought were interesting anyway for me as a numbers guy. Is the Roman numerals are 1, 5, 10, 50, 100, and 500, and that's what they had to speak with. And if you add those up, it adds up to 666.
Uh-huh.
And that's the number that the Bible has made famous in Revelation.
I know.
And as far as the small sentence that's the secret to the universe or, you know, whatever they're trying to find, I came up with one night. I woke up in the middle of the night and I wrote it down. And I've studied it. I've looked at it for years now. And I've talked to some pretty smart guys about it. And nobody can give me a yes or no. But here it is. I'll just give you the statement. And, it's pretty deep. Subject and conversation, obviously, but
no,
the formula
right.
is I equals zero.
I equals zero.
That is, it's a small I equals zero. And I woke up on the anniversary. It was June 24th, 1999. And it was my 17-year anniversary of the day I was supposed to graduate high school. And I woke up in the middle of the night and wrote this down. I woke up in the morning and wrote out a whole paragraph. And there's a theory, Art, that there's a number. It's a number that nobody can explain. It's called the square root of -1. You know, 1 times 1 is 1. -1 times -1 is +1. What number can you multiply times itself to get -1? And for that matter, any negative number. And so that's the puzzle that mathematicians have been chasing forever, and I believe the answer's been right there the whole time. I think it's zero. And so I think that might be maybe, you know, who knows who's listening, it might play a part in helping them come up with that, what you're looking for there.
It might, Scott. Here's another one for you. With really, really brilliant people like Einstein and some modern theoretical physicists, they have their most brilliant years very early. And then past a certain point, I don't know, maybe in their 20s or at early 30s at the latest, they begin to go downhill. And so if they're going to really make a giant discovery, it's going to be in those early years.
Huh. Well, mine was 36, were my calendar and the nine theory. And the matrix, I discovered what's called the math matrix. And people can see that at the site that you have is connected to. And it's a grid that goes 0 through 99, and I woke up with that one night, and that's going to be in every classroom in the country within the next year. It's called the Math Matrix, and it's just a grid that's 0 through 99, and it reveals nine patterns and numbers that nobody ever noticed. And I introduced it at the National Math Convention, Art, where there were 500 math teachers that teach teachers math and write curriculum standards, and I showed them that every number in the universe goes down to nine. And I turned around and I said, how many of you knew that before you walked in the room today? And not one teacher raised their hand. And so that just blew my mind. And then I was the keynote speaker in Amsterdam at the National Math Convention there. And I went to the World Mental Math Championships in Germany last year and met the top 17 human calculators in the world. It was the funnest 4 days of my life. It was amazing to talk to guys that think like I do. And
What was that like? I mean, you meet another person who can do, and by the way, was it all guys?
No, great question. One girl, she was from Germany, and it was held in Germany, and there was three or four German guys, people from India, Pakistan, Libya, you know, the square root king.
Yeah, but just one girl.
One girl from Germany, and she was amazing. She went for the overall. There were six contests. I just set my world record for my counting skills at 36, and nobody could beat that. I met the multiplication king, the guy from Germany who can multiply 2 8-digit numbers together in less than 30 seconds, which is no big deal to most people, but it's mind-boggling because I, you know, knew what he was doing. And the other thing we had was a human calendar contest. There was about a half dozen of us that could all calculate the days of the week instantly. And so they have six people lined up and a judge yell out a date and six people yell out the date. And the girl was part of that too. It was just fascinating. And we learned so much about each other, about how we see numbers and why we think the way we do. And I introduced the nine thing to everybody from every country and they all took it back with them. And none of them have sent me anything to show me documentation that it existed there before.
Huh.
So I can't explain it, but I feel like, I have an opportunity to really help people see numbers in a clear way. And all these guys sat down, we went through all this stuff together, and now they're helping me disseminate that around the world. So I don't know if it's going to make all the difference in the world, Art, but I can tell you when I leave a school visiting kids and I see 30 kids or 300 kids get excited about math and be able to add a small column of numbers in their head and look at numbers in a fun way and not be afraid, I really feel like that's going to open up doors that we cannot comprehend or calculate, because which one of those kids is going to be awoken or inspired to maybe cure cancer? You know, it's incalculable.
Well,
so it's a blast to go in there every day and see these kids get the light bulb go off in their brain one more thing.
When you do pass on, are you leaving special permission to, you know, have your brain, you know, sliced and diced and examined?
I guess I had to consider that. I'm open to suggestions. I mean, just like religion, it seems like all we think about doing is trying to figure out how to avoid death or overcome it or delay it or make it not exist, you know. And
if only.
You know, so I don't know what that means, but I feel like when you ask me to do calculations, when I do these things, I go into a timeless state where time doesn't count, and that's why I do it so fast. To me, it feels like I'm taking forever, a couple seconds.
Would you describe it as a trance state? In other words, does everything else around you blur and go away?
Sometimes, but I can also, you know, I was in a golf tournament and a kid asked me to count by some number, and I teed up my ball and hit an 8-iron within a foot of the hole the entire time counting by a number.
Huh.
So I was learning at the same time. I didn't know if I could do it or not, but it worked out. So,
well, that almost sounds like it's something that you can do with just part of your brain, a kind of a multitasking deal where, yes, where you can do that and concentrate on something else at the same time. Would that, yes, be accurate?
Absolutely accurate. And, I didn't really know that about myself until recently.
That is fascinating.
Yeah, I always went into a zone. You know, especially when you're performing at events like that, you know, you're doing world records and stuff, and you're calculating. There's not one digit that can be wrong. You know what I mean?
Okay, so would you describe what you do as you have to concentrate, or, in fact, you can be, as we just mentioned, sort of doing something else and thinking about something else or concentrating on hitting a ball and do every bit as good a job?
Yes, and I actually seem like I go faster because I believe the key is relaxation. And if you said to me right now, Scott, I want you to list off the charts, the elements, you know, we're going to have a long conversation. But if you said 42 times 19, I'm excited to answer you. I'm in a relaxed state. And so the people that I meet aren't. They're anxious as soon as they say, oh, I'm going to meet the human calculator. Great. I'm going to have to think about numbers. They're anxious already. Me, I'm like, great. So I'm trying to just get people to at least halfway.
Gotcha. All right. Time is short. So again, if you were to send somebody to a website or recommend your book or whatever you want to do.
Thanks, Art. Thehumancalendar.com is, you know, this year is the first year that my calendar lines up with the Gregorian calendar. My zero day has to be a Sunday, and 2006 is the first time. The next one is 2012, interestingly enough. people can download it for free. And then my books are available at humancalculator.com, and they can order those DVDs and workbooks for free as well.
All right.
And that's all I got.
Well, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the program. And obviously, we could have used a lot more time because there's so much to explore here. So what will happen is we'll schedule you back.
I'd be honored, Art, because I wanted you to be the first guy to hear the word two-joker poker. It's a new poker game I invented. It's going to come out in September in Las Vegas.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I heard about that. All right, we'll cover that in the next program, new poker game. All right, bud, thank you.
Pleasure, Art.
And good night. Al quit his NASA job to write and promote what became as the number one L.A. Times best-selling book. It's called Soul Traveler. Al was a crew chief for the ultra-secret U-2 planes earlier in his career, was part of the stealth program, and was just recently one of the engineers responsible for some of the design of the U.S. space station. So, again, the very last person in the world you would expect to be doing what he's doing. It just simply doesn't make sense. Kind of like the human calculator. But it is coming up in a moment. Well, it's been a long time, so we're going to retread some ground with Albert Taylor. Albert, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Art. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good to have you. Yeah, it has really. When was the last program that we did together? Do you recall?
I'm not exactly sure, Art. It had to have been at least 3 years or plus ago.
Yeah, I was thinking about that much.
Yeah.
All right.
You know, Art, I have something I need to share with you because sometimes we do things in people's lives and we aren't aware that we've created miracles in people's lives. And I want to share a brief story with you to kind of let you know some things maybe that you weren't aware of.
I'm listening.
Back in 1996, when I did quit my job on the space station, I decided to start my own publishing company. And the first product was, of course, my self-published version of Soul Traveler. Well, shortly after that, I got some really bad news from my distributor who went bankrupt with about $100,000 of my money.
Mm.
And that was all my money I needed to pay bills and really support myself. A couple months after that, I was literally sitting on the edge of my bed at 2 o'clock in the morning with an eviction notice in my hand with a repo man. The repo man was looking for my car, and all my utilities in my house were going to be cut off in about a week.
Brother.
But because of my spiritual experiences that I've had, I said a prayer. I said, you know, I really thought you wanted me to do this, and if you really do want me to do this, I need a miracle. I went to bed, and I woke up the next morning, and I decided to check my email account, which on AOL, and after sifting through, there was an email in there from a gentleman, said his name was Art Bell, and he said, please call me. And I opened up the email, and there was a number in there, and I called. And on the end, other end of the phone was this raspy voice.
That's me.
That so many of us have heard over the years. And I have to tell you, if you remember that night, it was 1996. I asked you, how long did you want me to do the show? And you said about an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I ended up doing the whole 5 hours.
That's right.
And the phone lines lit up.
Yeah, well, there was a reason why I wrote to you. I mean, it had started to come up on the program again and again and again. I had callers who were making claims, and I had had an experience myself that I'm sure
right.
you recall. So,
yeah, your Paris experience.
Yeah, so it got to the point where I had to know more, Albert, and it seemed like you were the one. I mean, you had, you know, almost the Bible of it out there.
Well, I want to say this. Between you and Danyon supporting me all these years in my book, you changed my life, and I'm deeply indebted to you, and I'm very, very grateful, and thank you very much.
Well, some sort of cosmic whatever, I guess. I'm glad to have helped. I'm glad it kind of kick-started things. I guess that's what it did, right?
It definitely did that.
Yeah.
It was a wild ride, and it has been ever since.
Well, we specialize in rides here. And, you know, the very fact that, well, in the first hour, do you hear the first hour?
Yes, I did, yeah, about the human calculator.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I'm so entranced with the powers of the mind that we know darn well exist, but we can't exactly explain them fully. We cannot understand how they come to be.
Right. We're not even sure if the mind consciousness is even in the brain.
That's right.
You know, it's
That's
a
right.
fascinating reality is the consciousness.
Do you want to take, I frequently ask guests, a guest to take a stab at what consciousness is, to define it.
Well, I have to come from my experience and having these out-of-body experiences because I believe truly that it is independent of the physical body because I have traveled out of the body so many times and I consciously control where I've been going and have been places and verified it later on. So I believe, like the title of my book, maybe that is truly what the soul is. Maybe that consciousness and everything that we are is that mind and that consciousness. So maybe it is the soul, and that's the best way I can understand it, and it makes sense to me.
Yeah, that's as good as any, as far as I'm concerned, as good as any.
Yeah, it seems to be independent of the physical body, and you don't lose your humor and your sense of humor and your fears and your ability to love, and everything that you are travels beyond your physical body, so maybe that's what it is. You know, I remember when I was in Catholic school, you know, they used to say the soul was something that you had and, like, you carried around, like, a tennis ball in your pocket, and you could drop it and get it dirty periodically. Then you have to take it to a priest and get it clean.
Yeah.
But I really feel that it's not something you have. I think it's something you are.
All right. You know, you come from this hard science background, really a hard science background.
Mm-hmm.
It so totally does not make sense
right.
for you to be doing this kind of work now.
Right.
It's worth an explanation. How do you get from the hard science of space stations and you know, high-performance aircraft to this?
Well, it wasn't easy because I would say that when I first started letting people know that I was going to write a book regarding these experiences and on the space station, I had this little phrase that they would either run to me or run from me. And that was literally what happened sometimes, Art, is I would walk down the hallways in a different subcontractor at Johnson Space Center or wherever, and the people that knew me prior to me revealing this about myself would literally step to the other side of the hallway and walk right past me without looking at me.
Really?
Yeah. So it wasn't an easy thing to do. And the last thing I wanted to do, since I'd had a secret clearance for 27 years, was to jeopardize anything that I'd done in the past.
Listen, the first person you sat down with and started telling that, you know, you can leave your body,
mm-hmm.
Mentally, you can travel and I can prove it to you, your secret clearance would have been...
It was pretty much, yeah.
Shredded.
Gone in the wind, so to speak.
Gone in the wind, sure.
Yeah, they would have thought I had some kind of mental problem that would have opened me they would have been worried about me being blackmailed and revealing secrets and a host of other things that would have probably jeopardized that. And believe me, coming out with this was not an easy thing. I really labored over it emotionally for 2 months before the book hit. And I finally made up my mind. I talked to a gentleman, and he said, it sounds like it's more of a responsibility that you have to put this information out rather than
Albert,
desire.
Back away from the phone a little bit. You're,
you're
crackling.
I
usually have the opposite problem. Anyway, back away a little bit. So did you then figure, all right, look, I've written the book. It's coming out. I might as well quit. I might as well just leave the job. Otherwise, I'm doomed.
Well, they told me I had to go to Johnson Space Center for about 4 months to finish up some work. And at the same time, my book was going to be released. So I had to make the decision on whether I was going to stay and promote the book and everything that I've been doing, or whether to go on and continue to do my job and let the book fall by the wayside. Mm-hmm. And I finally made my decision that I was going to leave, and they were kind enough to keep me from quitting. They said, well, we'll just go ahead and lay you off so that way you can collect unemployment.
I see.
And that was nice, and that's what I did is I let them lay me off. And I tell you, Art, it was probably the scariest thing I've ever done in my life.
Yeah.
Because in aerospace, you know, there every Friday, whether you do work or not, you pull a little handle and the check pops out.
Mm-hmm.
You really don't have to worry about it. And now all of a sudden, I really didn't know if the book was going to sell. I'd never written anything before like that, only technical manuals. So it probably was the scariest thing I've ever done in my life.
All right. Again, going back to why I sent you that email,
mm-hmm.
I started getting all these calls about people having various states of paralysis,
mm-hmm.
people who would call up and say things like, you know, I felt like I was falling down through my bed and or rising up above my body, and it scared the you-know-what out of me, and
right.
I snapped awake. So after a number of those calls, I truly began to want to know what's going on.
Right.
It was obvious the number of emails I was getting. This was a real
phenomenon.
Absolutely a
right.
real phenomenon. Sure.
Right.
And so I guess it's worth explaining to some people who are tuning in tonight and saying, what the hell are they talking about? Traveling outside of your body.
Right. There's always someone coming up who hasn't heard this. And,
well, of course.
My story begins when I was 5 years old. And I would wake up in the middle of the night paralyzed and not knowing what it is. I could see and hear, but I was incapable of moving my physical body. And it was very terrifying. And on top of that, I would often see a transparent shape, a humanoid shape, sitting on the edge of my bed calling my name.
That's terrifying.
It is. For a five-year-old, it was very terrifying. And because my family is very superstitious, when I was able to move and jump out of my bed, I would go running into my grandmother's room, who stayed with us at the time, and I would say, Grandma, I was paralyzed and I couldn't move, and there was somebody calling my name. And my grandmother, God bless her soul, she would say, well, that's because a witch was coming to steal your soul, and because you were bad, now go back to bed.
You're a devil child. Leave my presence. Yes.
So, needless to say, I'd go back to bed, terrified, staring at the ceiling, covering myself up with the blankets, you know, and stay up all night long because of this phenomenon. And that was the explanation of it. They'd call it the witches are riding you or the haints. And that's something that my family's from the South in New Orleans, and that was pretty much the accepted norm for this phenomenon.
All right. Prove it to me. In other words, you've done it in the past.
Mm-hmm.
We'll let history repeat itself, Albert. Give me if I were to ask you for the best proof that you've got
mm-hmm.
that OBEs are real, and when I say proof, I mean external confirmation
right.
by
right.
somebody or whatever, the best cases you can give me that prove that this is true, what
right.
would you say?
Well, you know, and that was important to me to prove it, because without these two experiences that I think were extremely important, I would have thought, well, maybe it's just a lucid dream. Well, one time I was attending this class at the local college out here in Southern California, and the class was being taught by a doctor who had had a near-death experience.
Mm-hmm.
And during the middle of the class, she said, has anybody ever felt paralyzed? And outside of my family, no one had ever asked me that. So I immediately raised my hand, and she said, I think, and she was the first person that said this to me, I think you're on the verge or you've been having out-of-body experiences. And I have to admit, I laughed at her because I thought that was the most ridiculous thing I'd ever heard. And she said, you can't tell me what you don't know. And I said, well, it happens to me almost 3 times a night sometimes. She said, the next time it happens, I want you to think about seeing me and come to see me. And I thought, okay, it probably happened tonight. I'll try that. So, of course, that night, I found myself paralyzed. I found myself floating up out of my body. I could see the room. And I thought about it. I thought, okay, I want to see the doctor. And the strangest thing happened is all of a sudden I felt two hands grab me and kind of push me toward the window. The next thing I knew, I was flying like I had done so many times before, but never from consciousness all the way to this experience. I traveled faster than I had ever traveled in my memory. I could go higher and faster than I'd ever done. Then finally, I was being drawn to this house that I'd never been to. I kind of entered through the ceiling and literally saw all the wiring and insulation in the attic. And then I found myself standing at the foot of this bed, and in the bed appeared to be the woman that I wanted to see, the doctor.
The doctor.
Yeah. And I was still thinking, this is probably a dream. One of the things I noticed, I knew she was married, but I didn't know that her husband slept way on the other side of the room. And I thought, well, if I'm really here, that's a good thing to remember. Another thing I noticed was that on her leg, there appeared to be a cast. And I thought, okay, if she, maybe she hurt her leg or something, that's another good thing to remember. So after a while, I felt uncomfortable being there, and I decided to return. And it was simply, I want to return. And I felt the same hands grab me, the rush of moving away from that scene and extreme acceleration. And I literally felt like I was slammed into my bed from the ceiling. I jumped up, and I grabbed my journal, and I wrote all this down. Well, this happened on a Saturday. That Monday, she was teaching her class again, and I couldn't wait to see her. So I approached her during a break, and I said, you know, doctor, something really interesting happened to me on the weekend. And she, before I could finish, she said, you know, I had a dream on Saturday that you were standing at the foot of my bed.
Really?
And I thought, oh, my God. And I said, well, you know, I had a dream that I was there because I hadn't accepted it as an out-of-body experience yet. I said, I had a dream there, and I noticed that in the room, in my dream, you and your husband slept in two different beds. And she says, matter of fact, not only do we sleep in two different beds, but he sleeps way on the other side of the room because he has sleep apnea. And I thought, well, wow, that's amazing.
Yes.
And then I looked at her leg, and I didn't see any injury. And I said, well, in my dream, you had something was wrong with your leg. And there was this white cast or something. She said, no, I don't. It wasn't. There's no injury, but I do sleep with a white heating pad wrapped around my leg.
Wow.
And that's when, even then, I was still skeptical, but it started leaning me into the direction of thinking, oh, my God, maybe this is real. And if it is real, what is it? What part of us is doing this? And how come we humans can do this kind of amazing thing? And that was the beginning of me venturing in and verifying my experiences and slowly coming to the realization that the soul is capable of temporarily leaving
the body. All right. How many other or similar examples can you cite, either that has happened to you or to others?
I can cite two more that are really amazing.
Please do it.
The second one was, by this time I thought, well, I mentioned it to a friend of mine at the space station division, and she was a metaphysician at that time. I didn't know what that was. I'd never heard of it because, you know, I was Catholic. And she said, well, you know, I think you're astrally projecting. And I didn't know what astral projection was. I thought it was astral like the dog on the Jetsons. I had no idea what that meant.
Yes.
And she said, you can leave your body and visit people. I said, well, I think I had an experience with this doctor, but she said, I tell you what, next time, come visit me. And I thought, okay. So the same sequence of events happened before. I floated out of the body. I made my request. I want to see my friend. And the next thing, I had these hands grab me the same way, push-pull me through the air. I ended up, the location I ended up in was this apartment in a dining room. And I looked around, and the first thing I noticed was that in the dining room, there was this humongous chandelier. I mean, it dwarfed the dining room, and it literally didn't look like it belonged. And I thought, okay, that's a good thing to remember. Then I moved down the hallway, and there was the last door on the right. I moved into that bedroom, and the strangest thing is that normally when you have twin beds in a room, the window is in the center and the twin beds are on either side.
Mm-hmm.
But this window was in the corner of the room. And I thought, well, that's kind of strange. And I looked out the window, and half of it was blocked by a telephone pole. And then I looked out, and I could see the alleyway below and an apartment building across the way.
Hmm.
So I returned exactly the way I did on the night that I saw the doctor. Literally was slammed in my body again or under the bed, jumped up and wrote all this down. Well, when I went to work, I got a chance to see my friend, and I said, you know, I think I had another one of those lucid dream-like experiences. But I said, I ended up in this dining room with this humongous chandelier. And she said, you know, I bought this huge chandelier at a swap meet, and it's really too big for my dining room, but I couldn't bear to let it sit in the box and get dusty, so I decided to hang it up. And I thought, well, okay, that's an interesting coincidence.
Mm.
Then I said, I went down to this room the third one on the right, and I went in, and it had a really odd window in the corner. And she said, before I could even tell her anymore, she said, that's the strangest room in my apartment. I don't know why they put the window in the corner, because you can't see out of it very well, because half of it is blocked by a telephone pole. And I thought, oh my God.
Yes.
Oh my God, this is real. And I described what I saw outside. It matched her description perfectly. And I wrote this down, and that's when I started leaning into that direction. Now, recently, I had a really interesting experience where I saw a friend of mine, his name is Bill, on the astral plane. And I thought to myself, you know, I didn't know Bill could travel out of his physical body, because occasionally you do encounter, you know, living beings and people who, you know, spirits who, or souls who've passed away.
All right, hold it right there.
Okay.
Bill will be the subject when we return. Once again, Albert Taylor, and we were talking about Bill.
Right. Bill, first of all, Bill is a good friend of mine, and I saw him on the other side, and I said to him, because you don't really speak like I'm speaking to you, it's more like a thought form or kind of like mental telepathy or something like that.
Uh-huh.
But you feel it, but it's very natural, and it doesn't, not something you have to, you know, try and do, or that's different from speaking now, but I said, what are you doing here? And I didn't know you could do this. And he said, I passed away. I died. And I was like, I was really skeptical. Because sometimes I still challenge my experiences, because you have to be very focused in thought, because you could have some dream material come in there and contaminate your out-of-body experience.
Yeah, now you're really making this is a gigantic jump.
Oh, yeah, completely. So after I returned back to my physical body, I hadn't seen Bill in like 3 months. So I went to, he lived in Downey, California. I went to his house, and I knocked on the door, and his wife, Marge, answered the door, and I said, hey, how you doing? She said, long time no see. We haven't seen you in a while. I said, well, I've been kind of busy, but I came to see Bill. And she said, Al, we haven't been able to get a hold of you. We tried to get a hold of you 3 months ago, but Bill died 2 months ago of cancer.
Oh, my God.
And I thought, oh, my God.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, I can't. If these experiences aren't real, I can't explain how come I knew these things and how come I had experiences telling me this, giving me this information.
Yeah.
So,
all right, Albert, I have several questions.
Sure.
Several times now you've mentioned hands.
Right.
Whose hands?
Well, in Catholic school they always told us we had a guardian angel. Well, a friend of mine said that this being that I kept encountering and kept touching me is more of a guide. Well, that's a belief system. Both of those are belief systems. But through my experiences, and I hate to just jump ahead because it sounds really incredible, but through my experiences, what I found out is that each and every one of us, you can call it a guide, you can call it a guardian angel, you can call it whatever you want, because it's still going to perform the same job. But each and every one of us has this higher aspect of ourselves. Robert Monroe called it an inspect entity, which means intelligent species, and his definition was a more advanced version of himself. Each and every one of us has this more advanced version of ourselves that's looking out for us in every aspect of the word, even trying to influence us to do certain things, or the right thing, I should say, when we're in our physical bodies. Sometimes you may call it intuition. So every one of us has this thing that's looking out for us. And if you really think about it, Art, what better guide or guardian angel or higher self to have, or something looking out for you, than a more advanced version of yourself?
Yes.
Because it's going, everything it does, everything it tries to influence you to do, is definitely 110% going to be in your own best interest.
Why then doesn't this angel?
Higher self, I don't know what label you'd call it.
Why doesn't this
on your belief system.
Why doesn't this guide pull us out just before we're hit by a car, or otherwise stop all these seemingly senseless, horrible tragedies that occur?
Well, that's when you get into another thing, factor that I never believed in, and that's when you have to look at whether this is the only life that we live. And if it isn't, which I have a lot of experiences that I've written about that I truly believe this isn't, then this is just one drop in the bucket, so to speak. Or, like, so let's say, for instance, when, you know, I'm talking about reincarnation, basically.
Yeah.
Let's just say that we've lived 100 times before, and this is our 100th life. Well, life and death really doesn't have as much of a meaning or a permanency as we think it does if this is just one out of 100 times that we've lived. Really what matters is the life experience that we have and what we've learned that we will take to the next life. So there is a given time period that we all agree to spend here on Earth, and that when that time period is up, then, I mean, be it trauma, unfortunately, or just dying in our sleep, that time is over, but we don't cease to exist. Our consciousness goes on. And one of the things I think is really one of the most interesting proofs of that is I've been a member of the International Association of Near-Death Studies for like 15 years now. And in the near-death experience, one of the things that I think is a clue that we go on is you have a panoramic past life review, which basically you get to feel and see how everyone you've met in your life is affected. Well, why would we have that panoramic past life review if we're never going to come back and be able to learn from that experience? So I think that's a clue that we come back, and if that is a clue, then, you know, what happens to us in this physical life, even though it's traumatic and sad and pulls at our heartstrings in so many different ways,
yes,
if it's only one of many, then it's not as important as we may think it is.
Well,
the important thing is the lesson.
These lessons, then, are all essentially subconscious because, of course, none of us recall consciously.
Well, yeah, in a way they are, yes. But they influence us in a lot of ways. Sometimes we do things and we don't know why we want to do things. Sometimes when you can go through a regression, which I've been through hypnosis, and you draw up all these memories of things that you never knew existed. So I believe that they may be subconscious, but I do believe that there's an aspect of them that is definitely influencing us.
Okay, here's something. So again, your belief system tells you these hands
mm-hmm.
are your guide. Is that correct?
Yes, my higher self. I prefer.
Higher self.
Mm-hmm.
All right. During an OBE, Albert, are you aware of yourself? I mean, in other words, do you still your physical self?
Yeah,
yes.
Oh, definitely. You can see it. I mean, Danny cracks me up because I totally related with what he said. It was the first time I saw my physical body laying there, the first thing that popped in my head was I thought I was a lot better looking than that. And that's the same thing that Daniel said.
Yeah.
Because you don't look at it. It's not you. That's the thing you realize more than anything. Or it's not you. It's like clothing you wear.
It's just a body.
Yeah, it's just a physical body. You're not emotionally attached to it. You know that you are independent of it. And it just doesn't have the luster that it had when you were staring in the mirror in the bathroom that
morning. So you mean you objectively get back from it a little bit and go, I'm one ugly sucker.
Yeah, you go, well, I'm lucky to have attracted the ladies I did,
Yes, they must have liked something about me, but I can't see it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't see it. So yeah, you really are detached. And a lot of people in the near-death experience have that same experience. They also feel very detached from the physical body and don't have any emotional ties to it.
Well, you definitely don't look your best when you're dead.
No, or unconscious or drooling or any of those
things. Yes, that's right. That's right. Okay, well, so, you know, this is real. And I suppose after you wrote your book, you
mm-hmm.
probably, if my guess is correct, you were inundated. You were probably buried in emails and letters and correspondence from people because this is going on all around the world.
All over the world.
Yeah.
From Greece, Turkey, New Delhi. I mean, amazing places.
Yep.
People sharing with me parts of my story, things that I'd already experienced, and then other parts of my story, parts of their story that I hadn't experienced. And I think one of the most interesting things that somebody shared with me is you calling me from Paris, telling me about the experience you had.
Yeah.
I think that was amazing.
Well, it was an amazing, truly amazing experience, Albert. I was outside my body for just what seemed to be a very few instants, but oh man, there was no question about it. I absolutely was outside my body. I was within visual distance out my hotel room of the Eiffel Tower, And with Ramona asleep, and all of a sudden, just for no apparent reason whatsoever, kaboom, I was up above it. I was in, I can only remember it as absolute indescribable joy.
Yeah.
It was total contentment and joy, and it lasted about that long.
Right.
And I was back. And I was scared, and I woke Ramona up, and I said, "My God, you're not going to believe this. You've got to wake up, and I've got to tell you about this." And I was extremely excited. So,
I know. You were so excited, you called me.
Yeah, I think
that's pretty excited.
Yeah, that's very excited. It was wild.
I think the most wonderful thing about it is, Art, is you ceased to be a bystander and became an experiencer. And there aren't that many talk show hosts who are experiencers. So now you're coming from two different perspectives. First, you were kind of skeptical, as you should have been, but now after you have experienced it, no matter how long you live, no matter how much time goes by, you will always remember that experience,
of course,
you will remember that it happened to you.
Yes, but you know what? I'm still kind of, I don't know, I'm kind of skeptical. Maybe I'm not about this. I try to remain skeptical.
Right.
But yes, when this thing happens to you, here's what I'm skeptical about, Albert.
Mm-hmm.
It's a living human brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that here's what I'm saying. Maybe my brain, in that unusual condition, I was in Paris, France, away from home, sleeping habits different, long plane trip, all the rest of it. Maybe my brain did something that made me think that happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
Our brains are just capable of so much.
Yes, they are.
And that's why I reached out to you for the stories, the proof stories.
Right. One of the things I have to say this, Art, and I understand your skepticism because I was, even after a myriad of experiences, I was extremely skeptical. But one of the things I have to say is I've had many, many, many dreams in my life, as have you. But out of all the dreams I've had in my life, none of them stand out like the experience I had in the out-of-body experience. It is really different. It's extremely exhilarating. It's unlike any type of dream that I've ever had. And why would that be? If it were just a dream or even a lucid dream, why would it be something so profound and affect me in so many ways if it was just like anything that I've been experiencing since I've been on this planet?
Yeah, sure enough. You said when you were, for example, in the doctor's room, there were a couple of things that you said to yourself, you know, I've got to remember that.
Right.
Now, that implies to me that you're fully conscious,
yes,
as conscious as
aware
you are when you're awake.
Yes, 100%. Maybe even super consciousness.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because if you, in that state, you're capable of getting information that you did not have or have access to when you're in the physical body. So I believe that in some cases, not 100%, but in some cases, when you're in the out-of-body, because it's an altered state of consciousness, when you're in the out-of-body experience, you do have access to super consciousness.
All right. Are all of OBEs in the here and now? In other words, every time you do an OBE, are you traveling to a place in the here and now?
Well,
or have you found that you have traveled into the past and or into the future in some OBEs?
First of all, there is no time in the out-of-body experience. You could feel like you had a three-hour experience and come back and look at the clock and find that you've only been gone for 15, 20 minutes. There's no time. It's irrelevant. But yes, access to the past and the future is something definitely possible. I've experimented so many ways, trying new things that's one of the things I did do. But I've also, that's probably one of the only and few warnings that I give to people is I warn them against traveling in the future because it is a very real experience, and any data that you gain from the future, it may come to be, and it may be something, it may not be something halfway around the world in Russia. It may be something that's going to unfold in your close to your life.
How about Connecticut? They've got that, what is it, $365 million lottery going on right now?
That would be wonderful to see something like that. I don't know of anybody who's recalled lottery numbers, but, you know, anything is possible. I don't think there's any limitations. But I do warn people against that because it happened to me, Art, and it's coming from the horse's mouth. I saw something that I did everything I could to change. I thought, well, It doesn't, if nothing's etched in stone, I have free will and I could change it. And this thing
break
still
it down.
Unfolded.
Break it down. What did you see?
It was the disintegration of my family, of my immediate family. That's changed. It's been years now. It's been
wait,
like
no,
10
no, no,
years
wait,
now.
Wait, wait, wait. Disintegration of your family.
Of my marriage.
Of your marriage.
Yeah. And my home life with my son and all that. I saw all that. And I did my best to try and stop it, but it still unfolded. And eventually, and it was really strange because it wasn't just the overall view of that happening. There were little things I saw, like numbers of on different types of papers that I had in that experience. And then those numbers, when I saw them in the physical, I went, oh, my God, I've seen this before. I've seen that number.
Yeah.
It was the strangest and hardest times that I've had to go through. And that's why I say, go everywhere. Fly around. Fly to the moon if you choose to. Fly out in space. Go into the past. But be cautious when you venture into the future because it is a very real thing, and you could see something or experience something that you may have to come back and learn to live with.
Well, according to what you just said, while you can visit the future and you can see or perceive things, you cannot change them.
I couldn't change what happened to me. I mean, I don't believe everything is etched in stone, but there are some things because I truly believe that life is a learning experience for more than just my soul. And other souls have agreed to have these experiences, and I'm just part of that. So certain things are going to happen to them that needs to happen because it's their desire and their purpose. So maybe I'm connected to that in some kind of way, and I can't influence that, and it's going to manifest anyway. So I pretty much end up going along for the ride.
All right. The majority of this audience has probably had the beginnings of an OBE. Describe the various beginnings that you can have. A very typical beginning if you're lying in bed and you're sort of on the edge of nowhere, near asleep, and what do you feel that could become a true full-blown OBE if you get comfortable with it and push it? How does it begin?
Well, the slower you go through the process of disconnecting, the more things you experience. The faster you go through, the fewer things. So let's talk about the slow part of it. The first thing you would probably experience would be the paralysis, and that would be because your soul is disconnected from the physical body. But it doesn't mean that it's just hovering there not connected to anything. It's connected to what Robert Monroe calls the second body or what metaphysicians call the astral body. The next thing that you would feel is because the physical body vibrates at a very low rate and the astral body vibrates at a higher rate,
yes,
you may start feeling a vibration of some sort. And that's the transition part. That's when your consciousness is moving from the physical body into the astral body. Once the consciousness gets there, then the vibration goes away.
So paralysis?
Yeah, paralysis first.
And then vibration?
And vibration. And then the next thing, right before you connect fully with the astral form or the second body, then you hear this incredibly loud roaring noise or electrical buzzing sound,
yes,
something like that.
Yes, I've been there.
And then when you connect, all of that's over, and then you may be able to see, and sometimes your vision cuts on by itself, and sometimes it doesn't, and you can command, I want to see, and you will see. And the next thing is sometimes you end up floating out of your physical body, and sometimes you don't. And if you don't, all you have to say is, I want to float upward. Everything that you experience in the out-of-body state should begin with, I want. And it literally asks, and you shall receive. Now, there's other things. There's other sounds that you would hear, like the buzzing sound could go to a loud roar. The loud roar could go to a loud musical tone or a note, and then the note could actually go to some type of musical sound.
Okay. Well, what percentage of the audience listening right now do you think identifies with one of the things that you've just said?
I'd say about 70%.
Oh,
I've already tested it.
Oh, how so?
I had a lecture that I did, and it was, matter of fact, they were distributors for my book. They weren't even coming to hear an out-of-body experience lecture.
Yes.
And I said, I'm going to mention these things, and I want each of you to raise your hand and keep it up. And when I'm finished, I want to look at the room. So I started saying, oh, how many people have ever felt paralyzed?
Yes.
How many people have ever heard their name being called while they were drifting off to sleep or waking up? How many people have ever felt like vibrating? And I mentioned all these things, and by the time I was done, it was about 100 representatives in the room who saw books to libraries and things like that. By the time I was finished, 70 people had their hands up.
Yeah, I believe it. I might have even called it, I might have even guessed a higher figure. Albert, hold on. Really, I've got to ask. Albert, astral sex. you know, sex is such a, in one way, big part of life, in right. another way, not a big part of life, but I mean, it's a very, it's one of the stronger human drives.
Right.
You know, be fair to say that, right?
Right, yes, it would.
So, if you wanted to have astral sex with a specific person, could you do it, or would you say, in the words of Richard Nixon, it would be wrong, but it would be wrong?
No, there's no judgment on it.
No?
At the lower levels of the astral plane, there is a lot of obsessions with different things, and one of those is the sex drive obsession.
Lower levels, huh?
Lower levels. It's not a judgment call. It's just that it's a lower vibrational thing, that's all. And there's a lot of, because, you know, the astral plane is populated. It's like I always tell people, if you're afraid of ghosts or entities and you go into the astral plane, that's like being afraid of fish and going into the ocean. That's kind of where they are. So at the lower levels of the astral plane, there is a lot of obsessions and things like that. And one of those is the sexual obsession or sex drive. And it's heightened tenfold, so it's a lot more powerful than it is in the physical plane. So there is a lot of that going on. I get letters from people all over the place who are saying, talking about that. And I've even heard people who've had near-death experiences talk about that. So it's definitely there. It's not like you would know the person. It's so more like sharing energy, even though the sexual feeling is the same. So that is definitely some people, that's some things that people do. It is there. There's no judgment call on it. I could care less what people do on the astral plane in that regard.
Well, let's ask,
it's definitely there.
How common is it? I mean, I saw a story earlier on CNN today where they said the new rage is porn on your cell phone.
Yeah, I saw that too.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
I mean, so, look, it's apparently everywhere, really.
It is part of human existence, not just the physical existence. But the thing is that there's a lot more to why there is a sexual drive and sex on the astral plane than just procreation, because as far as I know, I haven't seen any astral babies flying around or anything
that's
like
a good
that.
That's a good point, yes.
But
yes.
So that means then why is it on the physical plane, because we usually think of it as procreation, but then why would it be on the astral plane too?
Well, all right, here's, I think, a fair question.
Mm-hmm.
Does astral sex always have to be consensual?
And no, and you know, and
that was a no.
No, it doesn't. It can be something that can be catch a person by surprise. They may not even be thinking about it. It doesn't have to be at all.
Mm.
And you know, I've been involved. I run a paranormal research investigation group.
I know.
We've done some investigations on people being attacked sexually.
Yes.
Like four in the last 4 years.
Yes.
Which is shocking.
Well,
you know?
I'll tell you, Albert, I'm glad we're on the topic because I really have had, I've done shows
mm-hmm.
on people who have been attacked. And man, Albert, I get all these women who have called up and, you know, they will just absolutely up and down tell you they were sexually assaulted.
Right. Yeah. We've gotten many, many, many reports, and a lot of people, a lot, especially women, and we've done one with a male too, but a lot of women, they've been suffering in silence because they wouldn't tell anybody because most people wouldn't believe them, but
well, of
as
course
we gained
they
their confidence, they began to share with us that this happened to them.
Of course they would not be believed.
Right.
You know, for that, you need physical forensic evidence,
right.
And it's not that kind of thing.
Right. Even though there's this one 82-year-old woman that was attacked in Tustin, California, and she had, this was the most shocking thing I'd seen in a long time, Art, she had bite marks on her upper thigh. I mean, close.
Wow.
And the first thing I did is, because I'm a researcher, I said, do you wear dentures? Because, you know, we run into a little bit of psychosis and
yeah.
things like that, people doing things to get attention, and of course
sure.
she didn't.
Sure.
But they were the oval pattern teeth marks on her upper thigh that I examined and took photographs of myself. It was startling.
That is startling.
Yes, it was.
The whole concept of an attack, you know, I mean, really, for these women, for these people who are attacked, it is every bit as bad as a rape, I guess. In most cases,
it's,
right?
It's worse. I would say it's worse because you can't call the police. There's no place you can go, you know. I'd say it's worse. And then it even challenges their sanity.
Yep, well,
because
sure.
of the nature of it.
All right. Is there, in behalf of these women, mostly women, is there anything they can do to protect themselves from this kind of an attack?
I'd say there's something you can do to prevent it from happening again,
yeah.
but it's only 80% reliable. So there's 20% that we haven't been able to help in our investigation.
Which is?
I don't understand how this particularly works. Maybe it has something to do with prayer. I don't know exactly. I just know it works. And there's something called a clearing, and that's when you go around. I have some intuitives on my team. They go around with sage, chanting different types of prayer, protection prayers, things like that. And in the cases that we have done that, it's 80% of the time the phenomenon has ceased. But then there's 20% where it continued on, and we weren't able to affect it in any way, shape, or form.
Fascinating.
Yes.
Fascinating.
It's startling. I never knew something like that really existed. I've read books on incubus and succubus and things like that in Greek mythology, and I saw the movie The Entity that Barry Taft was involved in.
Of course.
But I never really believed that something like that existed until I got involved with these investigations. And it was shocking. It is shocking.
Well, it is. And what do you ascribe the 20% to? Do you feel that it's that the negative entity, we'll call it, just for lack of a better name, is of a sufficient strength to simply overcome whatever power, the prayer, or...
That may very well be. It may, because the people come from all walks of life. One was a social worker for the city, and so they don't have anything in common as even religious beliefs. So I would think that this particular thing, maybe it's just, maybe we haven't found what will affect it yet, because we haven't tried everything there is.
The psychiatrist, of course, Albert, would say, look, even with regard to the bite marks on,
right.
on the thigh,
right.
the mind, the human mind, is a very, very powerful thing, and if it believes that it's been attacked, it will actually produce marks and bruises and things like that.
Right.
And what do you say in response?
I know. I've seen the studies where they placed a quarter in the person's hand and told them it was hot, burning, and it actually left a
That's
ring,
right.
and the mind actually believed it and
right.
it created it.
Right.
So I've seen that.
And so how do you respond?
But I have to say this. There's one investigation that I went to that was the most startling investigation I've ever seen. I was a 15-year-old girl who her mother claimed that the girl was being attacked by something. So we arrived on the scene. The first thing I did is I had an investigator examine the girl, which there were no scratch marks or anything on her body, and followed the girl around just to make sure she wasn't going to scratch herself. And we were there about 2-3 hours. About an hour into our investigation, all of a sudden, I heard the girl screaming and saying, it burns, it burns.
Yes.
I went running in there, and there's photos of it on the website that I'll share later on, but I went running in there with my camera, and right in front of my eyes, she said, it's right here. She would lift up her blouse and show us her back or her leg, and slowly but surely, a red mark would slowly rise up out of nowhere and start raising up and then turn into a welt. And then actually started bleeding, and it was the most startling thing I'd ever seen in my life. Now, whether this 15-year-old girl was creating it, I doubt it, but, you know, anything's possible. I mean, the mind, the brain is capable, the consciousness, of creating things like that, but I think if that was the case, this girl is very, very, very sick. But we were able to do the clearing for this girl, and to date, to our best of our knowledge, the phenomenon hasn't reoccurred, so...
All right, when you say you were able to do a clearing.
Well, I can't really say me. I have people on my team that do that. Because I don't understand it, and I can't really say that I believe it. But I have people on my team that do it, and because it seems to work, I let them do that.
What essentially do they do?
They go burn sage. I'm not sure about the prayer that they say. They burn some type of incense. They do like an energy swipe, which is having the individual sit down and clearing the negative energy out of their aura. I think I don't understand it because, like I said, I'm a scientist, but
it sounds almost like an exorcism of sorts.
Yeah, to some degree, I guess maybe it is closely related because it is something very, very negative and very destructive, and they seem to be, they, and also what they do is what we do is we empower the person so that they don't, they realize that they don't have to be a victim. And that, all those things together has had, some positive results where the people have no longer been victims and reported that the phenomenon and attacks have ceased in 80%. But like I said, Art, there's this one, a couple women that she called me from Vegas. She was on vacation with her husband at 2 o'clock in the morning and was telling me that it was still attacking and there's nothing we could do for her.
I know, Albert. I get the calls. I talk to the women. It's true. And that's when I started doing programs on these attacks. I started realizing, oh my God, this is real. Not only is it real, but it's really prevalent.
Right.
And
yes, it is. That's the shocking part.
And, you know, as you point out, the women won't talk about it.
Right.
Except in a venue like this.
Right.
And then suddenly they will in droves, which
right.
means there's a whole
yeah.
lot of it going on.
Yeah, and that's the part that is, you know, in a non, I don't mean to be insensitive, but it scientifically it's amazing and fascinating. But unfortunately, there's victims involved. And I remember one woman told me, and it doesn't even matter what they're doing or what they believe, one woman was in the process of praying and was attacked.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's in a phenomenon that seems to be widespread. I was shocked that we have so many cases, and they continue on, and it requires further study.
All right. Albert, do you think that these attacks are all conducted, or many are conducted by people in astral travel, or do you think these attacks are done by entities that are in that plane?
Well, the part of the astral plane is here, and part of it is not here. And the part that is here kind of intermixes with the physical plane, like water with dirt. Creating
right.
this mud kind of stuff. So it is, you know, I don't have enough proof to say yes, but I do know that there is a lot of sexual energy in beings on the astral plane at the lower aspect of it. And if the wall or the veil between the physical and the astral is thin, maybe there is some cases where it's able to bleed over and actually reach out and affect
mm-hmm.
some of the
and
people.
And I take it that thin wall you just mentioned would be thinnest at the lowest level.
Right. Yes, exactly. And that's where that kind of activity is in the non-physical. So,
got it.
But how it chooses its victim, I have no idea because it's so random and there's no pattern. And they come from all walks of life and beliefs.
Can you describe for us the various levels of the astral plane? If we have just talked about the lowest a little bit, where do we go from there, and what determines where we are on that plane?
The vibratory rate of the astral plane is similar to the vibratory rate of the astral body. At the lowest vibration, which is still above the physical vibration,
yes.
is the lowest area of the astral plane. But as vibration increases, and that means that your particular astral body or soul has to be able to vibrate at a higher level for you to achieve access to these areas. If it doesn't, then you're going to be limited to a certain part of the astral plane. But as you start going up, part of the astral plane is not really here. It's meaning that it's not in the physical. And if you arrive there vibratory-wise, you cannot perceive the physical any longer. So the physical world ceases to be something perceivable. And what's going on is it changes into like a gaseous kind of no up, no down
mm-hmm.
kind of environment. A lot of souls, I've even encountered my deceased aunt in that location on more than one occasion. So I would say there's human souls definitely populating that area, but not as much as the lower aspect.
Well, are you able to travel in the various levels? Can you determine where you travel?
I've been able to leave the astral body behind and travel in what I call the light body or the etheric body and achieve levels higher than the astral plane.
Okay, so you're like a black belt. Soul travel.
I never heard that term before, but
I just made it up. I just made it up. I mean, obviously, you are able to go on these higher planes.
Yes,
in fact, actually, you're claiming that you've gone to what we refer to as the other side.
I've encountered, well, definitely the other side, but there's something beyond that. Well, a lot of people who have experiences, who have near-death experiences, report encountering the light. They call it, you know, whatever they want to perceive that is. And I've even had encounters on more than one occasion with the light, if you, you know. I've had numerous experiences in areas that, you know, like Danny and Brinkley described the Crystal City.
That's right.
There's really places on the other side that are, I guess maybe, consciousness as universal consciousness has agreed to manifest this thing to give us some type of stability when we do this, because without that, it would be very, very, disorienting. Because when you leave the astral body, all of a sudden, one of the things I notice is your vision changes to 360 degrees all at once.
Mm-hmm.
And because we're not used to that in the physical, that can be very disorienting.
Well, you and I have gone round and round and round about this.
Right.
And when I say that, I mean whether or not there is danger. Whether,
right.
whether or not when you leave your body, I mean, my God, Albert, I think I've said it to you before. What if you leave your body and your physical body dies? Now, you really wouldn't know how many people involved in astral travel have actually died during the experience. You
right.
You couldn't know that, right?
Right. No, we wouldn't know that unless we had in conversation with them on the other side. But I can say this to keep people from being afraid. Astral projection, and I've done it so many times, and my mother's 83 years old, and she does it, and I've taught it all over the world. It won't cause the death of your physical body. If it was going to happen, it was going to happen independent of you traveling out of your physical body. So, but if that did occur while you were out of your physical body, then it would be, you would go through the death experience, which would mean that your physical body would die, but then you would go into the panoramic past life review and then eventually have an encounter with the light. But there's no reason to be afraid. Now, regarding danger, because the astral plane and above, specifically the lower astral plane, is populated, there are beings there. Not all of them are astral travelers. Not all of them are even entities or souls who've experienced human life. So it's heavily populated. But there's no more danger there than there is in you getting up and driving to an ATM and risking some bandit coming up behind you. I mean, the world is kind of dangerous, but that the astral plane, there's no more danger there than there would be in normal life. There are some entities that will play games with you who will try to take advantage of your lack of knowledge and experience, but they can't hurt you. One of the things...
I'll bet there's Nigerians up there trying to get you to put money in the bank or
something.
Probably,
yeah, to send money over there, and they're going to... I've gotten that email. But the advantage that you have, Art, is that you can return to your physical body, and if they're not an astral traveler and just disembodied soul, they can't. So you can always run for home and be safe.
So you say. The Bible tells us. That's where you begin a conversation, right? Bible tells us. Albert, there are many, many people who believe in hell.
Right.
That there is a hell. Now, you refer to levels of the astral plane, with all of them, even the lowest, being above this physical plane that we're on.
Correct.
In your view, is hell a myth?
You're breaking me in right, aren't you, Art? You know, okay, I'm going to say this. I personally do not believe in hell, and I'll tell you exactly why.
Why?
I don't.
Why?
It's because on two occasions I had encounters with my deceased aunt on the upper middle area of the astral plane.
Yeah.
And if there was a hell, I believe that she would have been locked away there. She would have been there. So I can say this. She wasn't the best soul on earth. So I can say, unless she was on probation or something like that,
yeah,
I don't believe in hell, because I definitely think she probably would have been there.
Your aunt was that bad?
Well, she was an interesting, very colorful person. But, you know,
Wait a minute. There's colorful. You know, I don't think we go to hell for bad language.
No. Well, there was a lot more than that.
Okay.
She was active. Let's say if she was in Star Wars, she would have been on the dark side.
Okay. So she should have been there and was not.
And was not. And, you know, there's been people who've had near-death experiences that reported going and having hellish-like experiences. I've been on the other side a lot. I saw my deceased friend Bill. I've seen my relative, an uncle. I've seen my aunt, and I haven't encountered. I don't believe they get locked away. I think because I believe in reincarnation, it's very hard to believe in reincarnation and hell at the same time. I just don't have any experiences on the other side that would indicate that you get locked away somewhere because you've been a horrible person on this side.
Mm-hmm.
I would think, moreover, that you definitely do not rise above the lower levels of the astral plane, but eventually, because of the reincarnation process, you're going to get a chance to come here and do it all again. It's just going to be a lot tougher than it was the first time.
A lot of people, perhaps not so many in this country, but around the world, believe as a matter of faith in reincarnation. People in America have no idea how many it is. It's
right.
It's the better part of the world.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
And that's
it's
the truth,
growing,
folks.
You know.
Yeah.
A lot of people, you know, once you get past the belief system that you were taught as you grew up, you know, whatever religious belief system that is, through people's experience and exploration of the spiritual realms and becoming spiritualists rather than a particular religion,
right,
those spiritualists began to accept the possibility that their reincarnation does exist.
All right. Again, you've been doing a number of paranormal investigations. You've
right.
actually become involved in them, right?
Right.
All right. I've had some guests on my show from Utah. These are straight folks. They call themselves GIS, the Ghost Investigators Society.
Mm-hmm.
And, God, Albert, I've got to tell you, they've been on the show probably a dozen times now, and they do EVP
right.
recordings. And,
right.
Albert, I have gone six ways from Sunday trying to shoot a hole in what they do, and I can't.
Right. Well, I understand that.
Do you?
Oh, I have tons of EVPs that we've collected where it's very clear. And I know, first of all, I have one that's a little girl, and there was no little girl on my team. And there was another one, a guy saying, help me, and
too many little girls. Too many little children. Children.
No.
Too many children.
Yeah, well, and I can't explain how we gathered these EVPs. And I think the ones that are really fascinating is not the ones that seem to be some kind of recording. The ones that are really interesting are the ones that are interactive, meaning that they answer a question.
I know.
Those are the ones that I find fascinating, and we've collected them all over the place in all the investigations we've been doing for the last 4 years, and we're not the only ones, like you said.
Either way, they're fascinating. Now, here's a question for you, Albert. Since you're the expert in this area, who's to say that these EVPs are not soul travelers?
You know, because you are the same thing that a ghost is on the other side.
Yes.
It would be very difficult to draw some type of line between the two, because basically we are the ghosts when we enter the astral plane.
Exactly.
It's possible, but unlikely, because most people aren't traveling to, you know, usually when we go to an investigative site, it's because of a reported occurrence. Most people in the astral who travel astrally don't keep going back to the same site or same location. It's pretty much random, or rarely does it repeat. But I would say that it probably is not, but it is possible. Would be capable of probably leaving some type of impression on a digital recorder or an analog recorder on the chromium oxide tape.
Mm-hmm.
It is possible.
So you have collected yourself, then, EVPs?
Yes.
A lot of them?
Yes, quite a few. I mean,
one thing that
maybe even hundreds.
Okay, hundreds. One thing that stands out is that the personalities that come through on these EVPs don't seem to be particularly angelic at all. Many times it's scary. Many times it's, as we mentioned, children. Or, you know, if a person's personality is more to the negative, you get a lot of negative stuff. In fact, actually, Albert, though we can't play it on the air, you get a lot of bad language.
Well, you know, think about this, Art. Just think about them being the same way they were in life, and moving on, and a population the same where they were in life, and then moving on to a non-physical existence.
Yes.
You're going to get a variety of people. Not everybody, just because you lose your physical body, doesn't mean that all of a sudden you become evil, and it doesn't mean all of a sudden you become angelic.
Right.
It's going to be a good mixture of good and bad, or even in the middle, just like a good representation of the living population.
Sure enough. Well, that's exactly what you get. So I'm very interested that you followed that investigative trail. How did you do it?
Well, you want to know why I started doing it first?
Well, sure.
Well, it's really nice that people believe what I have to say about what I've encountered and what I've experienced. But as a scientist myself, to me, that's not good enough for me. I want evidence. I want data. And so that's when I thought about this for 5 years before I even created a group, Paranormal Research Investigations, PRI. I wanted to actually collect data that would start showing maybe the capability of the human consciousness to leave the body, and then, of course, the disembodied or deceased soul. So
right.
That's what was the motivator is proof and data to support everything that I had already experienced, and I didn't want people to have to believe me. So that's what motivated me. But now, since we've done that, I had no idea that my team was going to grow from 3 people, as a hobby type of thing,
right,
to actually maybe, I think I have 40 or 50 people on my roster that we do, that are investigators. I had no idea, and I had no idea that we would actually be collecting data. I mean, I thought this was going to be an exercise in futility. But we actually have
it works.
No, not only EVPs, though, Art. We have video phenomenon of things flying around that are unexplained. Yeah, to draw a conclusion as to what they are, well, I was calling a deceased person's name at that particular time, and this anomaly showed up. So you can kind of extrapolate on that and think what it could possibly be. And then at the same time, within a few seconds later, we ended up getting an EVP. So you put all 3 of those together,
right,
and it's starting to point in the direction that this could likely be, possibly be, the essence of this particular disembodied person or disembodied soul. So we have, and then that's not even including the still photos that we've captured, mm-hmm, of really strange anomalies. Presently, we've relocated. We have 3 different groups, or 3 different sections or factions of PRI. One is in PRI North. We call it PRI Anaheim, and then recently we've just opened up a section on the Queen Mary.
The Queen Mary?
Yeah, we're on the we run the Paranormal Research Center on the Queen Mary now. And because it's state of the art, I mean, it's amazing. One of the things that I've always wanted to do, being a native of Southern California, is the reputation of the Queen Mary, it was what a great place to be to actually see if there is any kind of activity going on. So we were able to, 2 weeks ago, do this weekend investigation of some of the reported hot spots or active spots on the Queen Mary. And surprisingly enough, not only did we get EVPs in the pool area, but we got an incredible photo near door 13 that was downright amazing.
Wow. You've really branched out, haven't you?
Yeah, well, a little bit. It seems to be growing. It's like developed this mind of itself. I mean, PRI, it was, like I said, it was just my dream, and it's grown to be this incredible, functional, scientific, paranormal research vehicle.
Are you going to write another book?
I've been working on Soul Traveler 2 and got sidetracked, and I'm also now working on Paranormal Research Investigator. It's called Diary of a Paranormal Research Investigator. So I am working on 2 books right now in between writing the screenplays and things that I'm doing. But I'm working on it. I know it's been a while, but life has its way of kind of guiding you down different paths.
It does.
Yeah.
And it sounds almost as though you've left Soul Traveler 2 and you're moving in a different direction.
A little bit. I'm still having out-of-body experiences once a week, Art, whether I try to or not.
Really?
So there is a lot to report. I mean, I just had a really incredible experience where I was talking about where Daniel Brinkley talked about the Crystal City. Well, there was this other place on the other side that I, for lack of a better name, I call it a way station. Maybe.
Okay, move away from the phone a little bit again.
Oh, I get so excited talking to you.
I know. I know.
It's like a way station. When people suffer traumas during the death process, it's like a place that they go to try to recover from that traumatic experience. And I went there astrally, and it looked like a train station almost, like a waiting room for a train station.
Really?
But beyond that, people, they actually were, there was something or someone arriving to, when these people had recovered enough, to transfer them onto a higher plane of consciousness.
So you've actually been able to visit, you know.
Yes, definitely. And that's amazing because, like I said, why would there even be a physical place there? But it makes sense because, you know, we are human and our experiences and everything are drawn on the human experience. So when you get on the other side, it would be very disorienting to all of a sudden thrust us into a full-blown spiritual reality.
Of course it would.
So that makes sense why that's there.
So there is this adjustment place.
Adjustment. Yes, there is an adjustment place.
There have been a lot of movies that have depicted exactly that about death, that
right.
That you go to this sort of, way station, adjustment point, place, whatever it
is. That's the best way I can describe it. People are traumatized. Some of them didn't know they were dead.
Yeah.
And eventually, because there's no time, something comes along to help them to the next level. And that wasn't even a month ago that I had this experience. So I can't say I'm moving away from Autobiography Experience books and Soul Traveler.
No, you're expanding beyond it, sort of.
There's so much going on. I'm trying to divide up my time to write two at the same time. And I don't want to write a book just for the sake of writing a book. I want to write a book to help people.
I hear you.
And that's pretty much what's more important than anything. So when I do have enough information to put into a book to make it a book, then I definitely will put that out because I get a lot of requests from my readers that they want to know what else is going on with me. So I definitely will do that.
All right. You know I did a number of experiments with human consciousness.
Right.
Really serious, startling, shocking experiments.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder what your comment on that would be. If you solicit mass human consciousness in a directed effort,
mm-hmm.
is it your view that you can, in fact, essentially move mountains?
Definitely, because you can do it on a micro scale where you can get one person to affect an inanimate object. So imagine collectively if you got people to focus on one intention.
Yes.
Definitely, I believe it's more than possible to do that because I believe thoughts are things.
Are you following the work at Princeton?
Pardon me?
Are you following the work at Princeton?
No, I'm not up to speed on that.
Oh, my goodness. The Human Consciousness Project.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know about that?
No, I haven't heard about that.
Oh, gosh, Albert. You can go online, folks, and find out about it. It's fascinating. They have these things they call eggs, Albert. And I'm going to try and do this very briefly so as not bore people, but these eggs are computers.
Okay.
These computers are spitting out random number patterns.
Mm-hmm.
They're all connected back to the mainframe at Princeton. It's been found, Albert, that it's been going on for years now. When large events like 9/11 occur,
mm-hmm.
it virtually goes off the chart. And the way they do the measurement is...
Oh, I remember. I did read something on that.
Yes. The way they do the measurement is all of a sudden these computers start to become non-random. They
right.
start spitting out random lines of numbers, essentially
right.
random. And it all reports back to the mainframe, and the mainframe, it's kind of like a chart. And
right.
and 30 minutes before 9/11, it just went flat
right.
off
sure.
the chart. Now, yeah. they also tracked many, many other incidents going back a long way.
Yeah.
Each time, it would go off the chart, sometimes 30 minutes before the event, sometimes when the event itself began.
Right.
But the correlation seems irrefutable.
Right. I do remember that. I just didn't remember it was at Princeton.
Okay.
But I do remember that.
All right.
Definitely. And that, to me, it's almost like it's measuring the universal consciousness and how we're all in sync. And when that universal consciousness becomes agitated in some kind of way, like a huge wave,
it's measurable.
It's like measuring that. So that shows you that thoughts or consciousness is not only is it an awareness, but it has influence on the physical world.
Oh, yes.
So, yes.
I'm thinking perhaps ultimately, it may be the greatest power there is. We talk about atomic power and so forth. Consciousness may alter the path of the world.
Once we are practiced, because it takes a lot of practice. But once we're practiced and able to harness the full power of our consciousness, I think that we will literally change the face of the earth permanently and change the nature of life on earth. I really, really do. I really believe that. I've seen people who, through prayer and conscious and their awareness, have their cancers have gone into remission. Me personally, I was supposed to be in a wheelchair 15 years ago and because of MS, and I'm not. So I believe that eventually maybe there won't be any illness. Maybe there...
Maybe not.
There won't be a lot of the things that we are plagued with today.
Finish this sentence for me. The difference between soul traveling and remote viewing is...
Remote viewing is like being watching a football game on television, and soul traveling is like being the quarterback on the field.
I don't know that I'd want to be the quarterback on the field. They get trounced just about every single play they're on their back.
They also make touchdowns, too. Did you watch the USC-Texas game?
And so there's no... Yeah, there you go. So there's no real danger, he asks again, in, for example, being the quarterback and getting severely injured.
Well, I can say this, and this is what I'm drawing on, because some people say, well, you got to tell them about the negative. Well, I would if I experienced it. I only experienced negative and fearful things in the very beginning of my travels. It's been years now, and I don't experience any. If there was something negative out there, I would think periodically I would encounter it.
Okay.
But I don't.
Well, then are there dangers for beginners that you are now past?
And the danger sounds like it's a very strong word. I would say that there's some challenging experiences that a beginner will probably have to deal with. But you can overcome it.
Scary.
And eventually they'll cease to be a problem.
Yeah, scary stuff? Once again, here is Albert Taylor. His book is Soul Traveler. If you're intrigued, if you've had the beginning of the experience or the experience itself, it doesn't matter. That's a book you ought to grab right away. And by the way, Albert, I assume they still can grab that book at Amazon and all the usuals, right?
Right. Because of the demand, my publisher is trying to catch up, but it's still out there, still available.
Okay.
If nothing else, it'll be just delayed a little bit.
And it will explain to you how to actually proceed with this. So many of the people that I'm sure we're about to talk to have had the beginning signs of this, and they're afraid to proceed.
Right.
Like me. I haven't changed in all the years.
You haven't, all right? It's been 10 years, all right?
No, I haven't changed. I find those beginning things truly terrifying. And I yank myself out of them every single time.
Oh, all right. What am I going to do with you?
I don't know. I just, you know, they are terrifying, Albert.
Yes, they are. I totally admit. And I even labeled myself an astral chicken. So I totally admit that they are. The only thing is that I can share with people is it's not like a light switch. You can get over the fear, and then you can explore.
How do you get over the fear?
You have to realize, just take little jaunts. Don't go very far.
That's over on the other side of the fear part. You don't get to go anywhere until you get past the fear part.
That's true. But I think the only thing you can do is just practice leaving your body, practice floating just a little bit above your body, practice basking in that paralysis vibrational area.
Okay, that's the part that I need to know about.
Yeah.
The paralysis, the vibration, the big buzzing sound, all of that. I've left once at the big buzz, well, more than once at the big buzzing sound. And I just can't get past that.
Right. You just have to bask in it and just get used to it.
Bask.
And then slowly move beyond that. And take it easy. Don't rush yourself. And try not to guess what is going to happen. Because if you try to guess, just that thought can create some dream material that can scare you.
Whew. All right.
You have to be an observer, which is, it takes practice.
Okay. International line, you're on the air with Albert Taylor. Where are you calling from, please?
Calling from Great Britain.
Great Britain.
Manchester.
Oh, Manchester. Oh, well,
yes,
welcome.
Sir.
Welcome to the program.
Fantastic.
Thank you very much. I was just wondering if two people can have a coordinately out-of-body experience together.
Definitely.
I've had dreams with friends where it feels like we're there together. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely. You know, you have to be on the same level as far as capability, but if you both of you can leave your physical body at the same time, you definitely will see each other, and it doesn't matter if they're halfway around the world. You can definitely have an encounter with them.
Caller, have you ever had that and then gone to those people and asked, you know, in some way whether they can verify it?
Yes, but it's always like we're having a dream together or something.
Well, it is. I guess, Albert, it is like that, right? Right?
Well, yeah, it depends on how consciously aware you are. You can be in a semi-dream state, and you can be in a conscious state, or you can be in a super-conscious state. It just depends on the individual.
Hmm. And how many times, when you've had a collective experience like the one he described, mm-hmm. does the other person come back and say, well, yeah, I had the same dream, or well, I was there?
Yeah, they, just like I mentioned in the doctor, when I was at the foot of her bed,
right.
She thought she had a dream with me standing at the foot of her bed. It just depends on her level of awareness and consciousness. If she's at a conscious level, she will remember the out-of-body experience just as well as I am. And if she's at a super conscious level, she will remember that and everything that it meant.
Now that you've got several years of this under your belt,
mm-hmm.
Albert, you said you still at least once a week
yes.
have soul travel.
Yes.
Have you progressed in the kind of travel that you do now since I last spoke to you?
I'd say definitely. I've gone further. I've seen things that I hadn't seen before. I had an encounter with my deceased pet, which I didn't even know that could happen. Definitely, there's been a steady progression, and it's also changed my interaction on the physical world with people. So definitely, I think everything that regarding the out-of-body experience is spiritual, and I think because it is spiritual, it's all about evolution
okay.
in the body and out.
All right, finish this sentence for me.
Mm-hmm.
The difference between soul travel and a near-death experience is?
Near-death experience, you're pretty much a passenger. You're not very much in control of where you go. You go into the light or through the tunnel.
Yes.
And then you're told you have to come back. In an out-of-body experience, you're 100%, well, not 100%, I'd say 95% in control of the actual experience and where you go, how long you stay there, and when you come back.
Huh.
One is you're a passenger,
but
you're a driver.
Okay, but you're traveling many of the same highways.
Yes, definitely, definitely. But one is you're a passenger, and one is you're the driver.
Okay. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Albert Taylor. Good morning.
Yes, is that me?
That's you.
I'm sorry. I'm Bob, and I was wondering if Albert has had the experience of meeting his soul parents. I had a sweat lodge experience where...
Did you say your soul parents?
Yes.
Okay.
Went through three or four layers of consciousness, and zoomed through the female and the male soul.
Soul parents.
I haven't had that experience, but I'm writing it on my things to do list.
Oh.
But I haven't had that one yet.
Okay.
All right. So that came from an altered state of consciousness. In other words, a sweat lodge is a altered state of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Albert, do you see most altered states of consciousness as pathways for this to occur?
100%, Art.
You
definitely.
Do. You
it
do.
It just depends on what your intentions are as to what manifests. You can have remote viewing from an altered state. You can have an out-of-body experience from an altered state. It depends on you.
What about drugs?
There are some drugs that have caused people to have altered states of consciousness. Peyote, I think Timothy Leary, talking about LSD.
Hallucinogens, yeah.
Yeah, hallucinogens. There are, yes, it is capable. There's some that hinder it, too. But it's such a very natural and easy thing to do as far as relaxation and visualization and clearing your mind that I recommend you just do it naturally and don't have to worry about it because you can do it as many times as you want.
Well, that's interesting. I always ask guests about this of your sort, and you have admitted, as most don't, by the way, that
mm-hmm.
hallucinogens could be a pathway.
Yes, some are. That's the history of an altered state. Native Americans have been doing it for a long time. That's the history. Yes, some do cause you to have an altered state, and then some hinder it. It just depends, but I don't recommend the ones that do at all.
What type of drugs hinder it?
Let's see, alcohol does, barbiturates. That's about the only ones I can think of right now.
That's fine. I get the idea.
Yeah.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Albert Taylor. Good morning.
Hi, Art. Hi, Albert.
Hello.
This is Sandra in Ohio. I'm enjoying the program very much. Thank you.
Hi, Sandra.
The 360-degree vision that you mentioned as part of an OBE state, I've had a few fully conscious OBEs myself, and I've experienced the same type of vision in my mediumship work, sometimes in a solid meditative state. But I was hoping you could comment on the concept of lucid dreaming. Mm. I've had a few lucid dreams also, or a number of them through my whole life, but a few where I was in two or three places at the same time, it seeming to view from two or three vantage points, mm-hmm. where in one I would be me thinking consciously as the human part of Sandra, looking out through my eyes, and then suddenly I'm at another vantage point where I have more knowing of what's going on in the situation, and I'm observing myself doing some kind of stupid, ignorant things, which mm-hmm. I guess I would normally do in my waking state. And then from there, I'm sometimes in a third perspective looking at the two of me. We're all observing kind of each other, the more ignorant human part, not being aware of the other two parts.
Are you too hard on yourself, Sandra? Yeah, exactly.
and at one point, I had a dream a few months ago where I actually turned in my ignorant state and realized someone was looking at me, and it was that classic vision of the higher self, the long gray hair type of thing. But this is the first time I was able to turn and look at that being and look into that being's eyes. And in the black part where the pupil actually should be, this brilliant white light came out, and then suddenly I was in that being's place, mm-hmm. looking out at the ignorant human self,
all this
knowledge came forward.
All right, let's back up a little bit and ask for a definition of lucid dreaming, Albert.
Okay. Well, lucid dreaming can occur while you're in the body. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're having an out-of-body experience. But lucid dreaming, as you progress in awareness, can lead to projecting and projecting the soul, the
okay,
self.
Okay, what is lucid dreaming,
lucid dreaming,
as opposed to regular dreams?
Well, regular dreaming is when you pretty much accept any type of thing that may be very odd, like a pink elephant or something strange like that, you accept it in the dream. Lucid dreaming is when you become aware and you know you're dreaming. You know your body somewhere is asleep, and you know what you see in front of you is dream material, and you can change it or you can fly, but you're in total control, and you're very aware. You become yourself instead of in that dream state where you pretty much aren't aware of yourself. But because you become aware, now you can move on to becoming having a consciously controlled, spontaneous out-of-body experience from the lucid state.
So the lucid dream is a state in which you're closer to the possibility of an OBE.
And it's a lot of fun because even I've had lucid dreams many, many ones. And I used to, when I was a little kid, I used to say to my mother, I wake up in my dreams, Mommy, then I fly, because I didn't know the term lucid dream at the time. But it's literally you become aware in your dream that you are dreaming, and then you can do all kinds of incredible things. It's fun in itself without even having an out-of-body experience.
Okay. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Albert Taylor. Good morning.
Yes. Good morning, Albert. Good morning, Art.
Morning.
Hi.
I had always had that paralysis, and I thought it was a dream.
Mm-hmm.
But in mine, it's not fun at
all.
No,
it isn't.
Oh, you're right.
No, it isn't.
I mean, with me, I would be aware that I was paralyzed, and for me it was like, you can't move, you can't breathe, if you don't wake up, you're going to die.
It's absolute terror.
Yeah, it is. You know,
absolutely. And I never went from there into the, you know, out-of-body experience, but I've had flying dreams,
mm-hmm.
only I thought they were dreams because it wasn't the present.
Oh, flying dreams are my favorites.
Yeah,
I love
too.
Those, but in the flying dreams, my fear of heights comes in. And I can't go very high.
Right. And that's exactly what will happen. Even if any fear you have will limit you. And one of the things I learned is to focus on the positive rather than the negative. I would fly over like a ravine, and then I'd look down, and then the thought would come into my head, oh, God, I hope I don't fall. And
then immediately
I would start plummeting down.
Well, my question was, the paralysis dreams, there would be a presence there, but it was never a good presence.
But
see, that might be subjective.
I mean, can you bring, if you allow yourself to go, can you bring back something bad?
Not that, to my knowledge.
You know, like...
But let me explain to you the feeling you had of something negative.
Okay.
Because fear is heightened tenfold, just the intensity of the fear is going to convince you that it's real, but it doesn't mean that that's a negative thing. But it's going to be extremely scary. Yes, there's always something around us. It's always there. But it's more positive. I mean, it's extremely positive.
But can you die?
To be feared.
Can you die?
Pardon me?
From it? Can
no.
The experience kill you?
No, not at all. Not at all.
I have a
and the paralysis, what that is, the reason you're having breathing problems
mm-hmm.
is because you have to relinquish or let go of control over the physical body. And it kind of feels like a mini death. That's why it feels so uncomfortable, because you feel like you can't breathe and you can't move. And if you think about that, it is, you're dying. Of course, the fear is going to be multiplied tenfold, and you're going to be very fearful.
See,
but it's about releasing control.
Ma'am, you're exactly where I get to, and that's where I give up the ghost, and I say, this is horrible. It's scary. I'm
out of
here.
It doesn't feel good.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I make myself wake up, and then I don't go to sleep.
Yeah.
But you can't move past it.
Yeah.
And then all of that goes away. The breathing problems, the paralysis, the weight on your chest some people feel, that all goes away.
I was overdosed on morphine in a hospital,
mm-hmm.
and... I literally couldn't move or breathe, and I coded, died. I had no experience, no memory of that whatsoever. But since then, I haven't had the paralysis dream.
Mm.
Could that have...
Well, you can induce it. And in my book, in Chapter 10, it teaches you there's 5 or 6 different techniques that actually teach you how to induce the paralysis. And if Art gives me a chance, I'll share one of the techniques with you on the air that everybody can try.
Let's rock. Do it right now. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, what you do is... eat before 6 o'clock because the body uses energy to process food. Go to bed about 10 o'clock and set your alarm clock to wake you up about 1:30 in the morning. When the alarm clock goes off, get out of bed. You can't just hit the sleep button. Get out of bed and stay up for about maybe 2 hours. Then go back to bed, and when you go back to bed, lay perfectly still. Get all your scratching and itching out of the way and lay perfectly still and stay there and just focus on that little area above your lip where the breath is coming out. Because what you're doing is you're trying to recreate a time when you, and everybody's experienced this, when you've been on the freeway and you're real sleepy and tired, and for that brief second you nod out.
Yes.
Even though you're trying not to.
Of course.
Well, now you're in a safe environment, and the body still requires about 2 to 4 more hours of sleep. And if you lay perfectly still, even if you try to stay awake, the body's going to fall asleep. But because you gave the consciousness 2 hours or 4 hours to sleep in the beginning, the consciousness is going to be very alert. And that's why we have dreams in the middle of the night, like 3, 4 o'clock in the morning like that, because the consciousness becomes more alert during that time period.
Yeah, that totally makes sense.
Yeah, so try it. All the listeners out there, try it. And I guarantee you a lot of people will have their, if they haven't had out-of-body experiences before, they will definitely have an out-of-body experience from that, the interrupted sleep technique, I call it.
And it's a plus, there's intent.
Yes.
You know, very serious intent. If you go to the trouble to set your alarm clock and you say, I'm going to give this a shot.
Right.
You have created a gigantic intent,
that
right?
Intent is important. Very important.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Yeah.
I wonder how many people will try it, and I wonder how many emails I will get.
I would love for you to get emails and even forward them to me or let me know. Because I have a feeling it's going to be
a very
people
large...
all over the world.
Yeah, I do agree. I really do agree. Yes. West of the Rockies, not a lot of time to the bottom of the hour, but you're on the air with Albert Taylor. Good morning.
Hello.
Hi.
I'll just get straight to my question. I'm really happy to talk to you, Art.
Thank you.
This has been plaguing me for about 15 years, and I wonder if you've ever heard of this, Albert, but I have had spontaneous, as Art has, out-of-body experiences, but I get caught up in this earlier on, very violent spinning force that I came to recognize about 5 years ago as the vortex that people talk about, and that was a huge epiphany to me to recognize it as such.
A violent spinning.
Yeah, and the very, very first time it was what I would call a lucid dream, and then immediately thereafter, maybe once or twice a year, and it's usually when I'm really tired, it happens in between the state of...
Yes.
Consciousness of going to sleep and being awake.
Like you're going into a vortex.
Yeah, just I don't see it.
All right,
but
I've got it. We don't have a lot of time here. Albert, what about it?
If you do not set your intention on what you want to experience, the astral body kind of just does its thing and it goes crazy. You can spin, it'll spin around, it'll bounce you off the walls, it'll do all kinds of things because it's not being guided. I don't know when you're having this exactly, but, and if you're flying around or having an out-of-body experience, electrical wires can kind of cause you to have that uncontrolled, trapped feeling too.
So you're
so it just depends.
Intercontinental, unguided, ballistic soul.
Yes.
You know, even if you've never done this, and you only do it once, it really is something that will allow you to suddenly understand that you are more than your collective flesh and bones and whatever you are, you know, your physical body. It will allow you to understand you are more than that. And that's one of man's biggest questions, of course. Circling back to what I said, Albert, I'm sure you get a very great deal of mail from all over the place, and I wonder how many prisoners.
It, you know, Art, it's funny that you would even mention it because I laughed when you said it. I get tons of letters from prisoners after doing Coast to Coast.
I would think.
I mean, I would, you know, and it makes sense. If everyone's on solitary confinement and when they literally say, I have nothing to do here, I want to learn how to travel out of my body. So I
yes.
get tons of letters from prisoners.
We got a big, big audience in the joint.
Definitely.
Albert, no
definitely.
Question about it.
All right, I wonder if I could mention a couple of things that I'm involved in that people may be interested in.
Rock on.
I'm teaching an ongoing out-of-body experience class here in Anaheim. It's called, it has a real catchy name. It's called Astral Knots, like astronauts, but it's astral. it's every Monday at 7 p.m. It's at what's called the Learning Light Foundation. And if anybody's interested in there and joining, the class is quite large, but we accept new people. It's 714-533-2311. And I'm also, I'd like to mention the website for the paranormal stuff we're doing.
Wait a minute. A lot of people are going to, you know, you give numbers and it goes right
past
people.
Okay.
Let me give it again. I heard 714-533-2311.
Correct.
And how long is this course?
It's ongoing. You know, it was only going to be for a month.
Yes.
But because the people there, I've even heard them say, you know, this is like my church. So the people there don't want it to end. So they all voted to have it go on indefinitely, and I that's what it is now. It's an indefinite out-of-body experience class that we teach all kinds of techniques and expand on them and share experiences, and it's just going to be ongoing. So if anybody wants to get involved, it's a real exciting class.
I'd be careful about calling it a church.
Yeah, well, I don't call it that, but they said that. They said it's like their church. I thought, well, in a way, that's so complimentary because I wasn't thinking anything like that, but if that they feel that comfortable, I assume that's what they mean, then that's great. Come, because there's some warm, loving people there, and like you said, you will truly discover who and what you really are.
Well, that certainly is true.
Yeah.
Even if it's only once, the experience absolutely will teach you that you're more than just what you're made up of. I got lucky, and how often, Albert, does a completely spontaneous, without warning kind of OBE occur?
Sometimes it can only happen once in your life. I know one woman never had one, and at 40 years old, she had one.
Right.
But if you intend, after you have one, the door swings open, so to speak, and it's up to you to pursue it. And it's easier the second time, and it gets easier the third time. So I suggest if you have one, then you can have a host of experiences if you aggressively pursue it.
Mm-hmm. All right. First-time caller line, your turn with Albert Taylor.
Hello. How are you both doing tonight?
Quite well, thank you.
Okay, I would like to relate some of my experiences and then get your input on them, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm. If you can do it fairly quickly.
Okay, I'll try. My second OBE I ever had, I felt like I was moving sideways instead of upwards, and I was coinciding with my wife's body as she laid next to me, and it was one of the strangest feelings I've ever had in my life. And then I felt like I was moving into her, I saw a woman, and she had dark hair, and she was really nasty looking, really mean looking. And she told me that everyone I care about in my entire life is gonna die on me or leave me or something like that. Something to that effect. I don't remember exactly.
Ooh,
and
nasty.
I heard baby crying.
Nasty.
And it really hit me emotionally. It was one of the most despairing feelings I've ever had in my life.
All right, we'll have to hold it there. But what he said, Albert, about traveling virtually into his wife's body next
right.
to him, that's fascinating.
Right, yeah, and when you do that, you should have been able to, I don't know if she was conscious, and I guess she was asleep, but you should be able to feel her emotions, too. So that's definitely possible. Now, the other thing that you mentioned, you got to really be careful when you're in that state of consciousness, because any wayward thoughts, any kind of thing can be created out of the substance that's around you, but it doesn't mean that it's real. Even something that appears to be an entity can be created. So the haggard, ugly-looking person that you saw may have been that something that you created, and because it was so intense, that's what I was mentioning before. The fear emotion is multiplied tenfold, so it would be so intense it would actually convince you it's real.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to be an observer, and it takes practice. But like I said, I've been doing this a long time. I continue to do it. My mother's 83 years old, and she does it, and she doesn't have any negative experiences.
But again, I think you sympathize perhaps a little less with people who are early on and really afraid of this because you're so damn good at it.
I do understand the fear, and I address that in my book. And I itemize the times that I was terrified. I mean, Art, I was so scared in the beginning that I would literally jump out of my bed in the middle of the night and go running through my house, turning on all the lights in the house.
Oh, I know the feeling.
And I would stay up all night long. And I had to be at Johnson Space Center in the morning. So I understand the fear wholeheartedly.
All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Albert Taylor. Morning.
Hi, Art. It's great to have you out there.
Thank you.
I have a question for your guest. I just wanted to tell very briefly is that I did accidentally do this when I was 11. I was lying there just in my bed, and I was still, and I was thinking, and I just sat up. My body didn't sit up with me, and then after that I had a lot of fun. And then I got scared and got yanked back by that string or whatever it was. But the main thing I wanted to say to you is it seems to me like implied and implicit in what you're saying is that that there is no death, and that our identification, our exclusive identification with this 3D reality and our bodies is just sort of a social construct or something, and I've been suspecting that anyway. What do you think about that?
I think you hit the nail right on the head. Like Chief Seattle said, there is no death, only a change of worlds. And that's truly what it is. And this is just like a play that we're acting in, and it's very temporary. And the play is going to end, and then we're going to return back to the place where we came from, which was home, and which is the non-physical realm.
Now, home, that's an interesting point, because I have always felt like there's something really important that I'm trying to remember. And it's like not just a fact, but more like a place or a realm or a state of being that I can almost remember, but not quite.
Well, do you meditate?
No, I get a little frightened when I wasn't frightened when I did the out-of-body thing, but I get a little frightened when I try to meditate. And, I'm trying something new. I'm trying to do it in a sort of a half doze lying on my back instead of sitting in a chair. So
well, through the meditative process, and I don't mean visualization where you think of things.
Uh-huh.
I mean clearing your mind and practicing ignoring the data that the five senses is giving you, through
right.
that state that you can achieve an altered state of consciousness. And the thing that you can't remember will be accessible if you practice it. There's nothing to be afraid
of.
I understand the fear. But if you practice it over and over again, I guarantee you that you will be able to access memories that you're having difficulty with now.
Well, I have a feeling that's very important that we do that.
It's probably about you and the essence of who you are. So I'd say it may be the most important thing that on this planet in your life.
Yeah, well, I'm wondering if it's the undifferentiated state that we may have all emanated from or something like that.
Well, if it turns out to be the number 9, I want to know. All right. Well, listen, thank you very much. Here's a question, and it is, I think, a good one. In the astral plane, Albert, have you met up with, and you've already said you have, other entities, in other words, non-human entities? I would think there would be a substantial amount of fear involved in that.
Initially, yes. Yes, I have. There's a host of beings there, like I mentioned earlier. So periodically, you're going to encounter souls.
I mean, is it like walking into the Star Wars bar?
You know, just about.
Really?
It's going to be souls who've never been incarnated on this planet as humans. There's going to be disembodied souls who were human. There's going to be astral travelers. There's even going to be pets, even. I discovered that recently. So there's going to be a multitude of souls that from all walks of life, or lack thereof, so to speak.
Okay. You said you discovered pets.
Pardon me?
You
yeah,
said,
my dog.
Said, yes, all right. Does that imply to you that our pets have souls exactly as we do?
It existed. I petted it. It was functional. I'd say it was as close to what we are as anything else is. Exactly. I don't know.
Well, I believe that.
It definitely was there, and it surprised me because I wasn't expecting it.
Well, I believe that.
But it definitely has a soul. To what degree, how it matches ours, I don't know.
So we see, now let's think about this, Albert. We see our pets.
Mm-hmm.
But I take it we don't see large amounts of ground squirrels and bugs and birds and other animals.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you make of that?
I really didn't even believe I would see a pet because of all the Catholic upbringing that I've had.
Yes.
But, you know, there's multiple levels of the astral plane. I don't even know if the astral plane, if there's something in between that level. So who's to say? I know there's a lot of things beyond that level. Who's to say exactly
yeah.
where these other life forms would go when they transition from the physical body to a non-physical reality?
It's a very good point,
say,
and I don't expect you to explain things that you cannot explain.
Right.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Albert Taylor. Hello.
Hi, Albert. Hi, Art.
Hello.
Two things. One is my experience, and one was my husband's. I, about 40 years ago, had what I believed to be my only OBE. I was sitting in math class. I was in eighth grade and very bored. And in those days, we didn't have air conditioning, so we had the window open to the classroom. It was a beautiful spring day. The sun was shining. The birds were singing. And suddenly, I was out flying around over the schoolyard. And it was just amazing. And I was like, okay, this is just really awesome. And then I realized I wasn't in my body and that I should be in class and that my teacher might call on me. And
I remember days like that in school.
but this was not my imagination. And so anyway, then I was back in the classroom hovering over my body. I remember looking down, seeing the back of my head, seeing my dress, and then snap back in my body. And I didn't tell anybody about that for years because I didn't know what an OBE was or that anybody else had ever had that kind of experience.
Right.
But I've never had one, you know, from the sleeping paralysis type of thing. So,
right. There's different ways. That what you had was called a spontaneous spontaneous controlled out-of-body experience. Some people, through the nap process, if you fell asleep, or even I've heard of reports of people writing me who've been jogging and get into that rhythm and find themselves above their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you had was something that sometimes happens to us that's spontaneous.
You want to hear
very natural.
The coolest one I ever had, dream. Mm-hmm. I guess it was a dream. I'm not really sure because it was so incredibly vivid. It was something like out of a Disney movie. I was at the very top of the Empire State Building in New York, and a fairy, go ahead and laugh, I don't care, a fairy or something like a fairy sprinkled me with this multicolored, I don't know, stuff. And I was able to fly up above Manhattan in the most free, amazing, wonderful flight.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was when I woke up, it was so vivid and so wonderful. I suppose that could have been an OBE, but I regarded it at the time as just a wonderful dream.
Right.
Really a good one.
Well, it could have been. Sometimes OBEs are mixed in with this dream material or this imagination material.
Yes.
So it still could have been, even though it had other elements to it.
Okay. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Albert Taylor. Good morning. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi, Art. I love the show.
Thank you. Where are you?
I am in Washington State.
Okay.
Albert, I'm so excited to get to talk to you.
Oh, thank you.
I'm a regular projector, a conscious and willing projector. And I haven't read your book, but I've read part of the Monroe Trilogy, and I'm discovering more about what's been happening to me.
Awesome.
My question was, do you think that anything, or have you experienced anything in your adventure so far that kind of give rise to maybe a thought about a change in human consciousness? Have you seen anything about us? You know, we've hit a low point in society right now with, you know, all the terrorism and everything that's going on. And so have you seen anything in your adventures that shows you that we're going to have a change in human consciousness and that this astral projection is going to be kind of a part of that?
That's a very good question.
It is a good question. I can't say there's going to be like an abrupt change, like, you know, a shift, but it's already in progress. There's a lot of people thinking are looking beyond the religious beliefs that they've grew up in and found things peaceful. Realization in a more spiritual way.
Mm-hmm.
When we become to dominate the planet with that kind of belief system, then things are going to change. They have to change because you cannot behave the way you used to. You have a new understanding. Even in my own personal life, my life has changed that there's certain behaviors and ideals that no longer serve me. So definitely there is a change. It may not happen in our lifetime because there's still a lot going on in other areas. But eventually I do see something, this planet changing and becoming truly like heaven on earth.
Albert, have you ever considered going into the future, not to view your own personal future? I have a sort of a personal concern about doing that.
Mm-hmm.
However, but going ahead to look at mankind's more immediate future, you know, 50 years, 100 years, 1,000 years from now?
I thought about it, Ari, but I'm so afraid now because of what happened to me that I pretty much stay away from that. But I definitely thought about it. Maybe that's a hurdle that I can't get over because of what happened to me. So I stay away from that.
That traumatized you, didn't it?
It really, really did. I cannot even stress how much it did.
I can understand. See the disintegration of your own family and then to see it begin to occur and not be able to do a damn thing about it.
Right. It was devastating.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm over it now, but it was devastating.
You're on the air with Albert Taylor. Good morning.
Yes, hello.
Hello. Where are you calling from, sir?
I'm calling from Mays Landing, New Jersey.
Okay.
Albert, I'd like to ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
A while back ago in November, I had a dream that my mother came to me and told me my brother was passing away. So then in November, my mother and him shot up to the mental home to see my brother and talk to him. And then December 8th, he passed away. Can you tell me what that is about?
A warning?
Is your mother alive?
No, this is my brother, my oldest brother. He died December 8th. I had a dream that my mother came to me and said, I'm just calling to tell you your brother passed away.
Right.
So my mother and him shot to the mental home to see him where he was at because he had mental problems.
Mm-hmm.
And then he passed away December 8th in the bed in the mental home. He died.
Well, it's similar to what's called a parting vision, except usually the deceased person comes to you. But this case, your mother was like a messenger.
Yeah.
So when you're in that state of consciousness, that's when they can reach us, and that's when they can communicate with us. So she was coming to you to share with something, maybe to soften the blow or to make it easier for you to accept what was about to happen. But that occurs quite often, and it wouldn't surprise me in the future if you actually had a dream about your brother. And
Albert,
he was healthy
we're,
and whole.
We're out of time, buddy. We are out of time. What a program. We're going to do this again, of course. In the meantime, you would like people to go to your website, right?
Right, yes. It's www.thepri.com, thepri.com. That's our paranormal website. And, of course, they can always go to alberttaylor.com.
Okay, got it. Take care. Have a good night. Thanks
for
being here.
Okay.
It's been great.